The time is 9:32 on January 31st, 2025. I call the meeting of Committee for Behavior Analysts to order. This meeting is being hosted via Zoom. The public and parties on this agenda have been properly noticed of this fact and have been supplied with meeting access instructions. Agenda item number two, the roll call. Ms. Malice, would you please call the roll?
Yes, Madam Chair. Dr. Byra?
Present.
Dr. Davey? Not yet present. Ms. Denton?
Present.
Dr. Rates?
Present.
Dr. Stenhoff?
Present.
We do have a quorum.
Thank you, Ms. Malice. On to agenda item number three, I want to thank everyone for joining us this morning, board staff, fellow committee members. I'm going to thank you all in advance for allowing me some grace today and future meetings as I step into this role and have to follow in the very fancy shoes of Madam Chair, Ms. Denton. So I will make mistakes. Let's just put it out there. I'm going to make some errors. Apologies in advance. Thank you for everyone for holding my hand through this as we continue through our meeting. As such, the Board of Psychology Examiners is approved by the BACB as an ACE continuing education provider. So you guys coming today, excellent job. You're going to get some free CEUs. So attending a meeting of the Board's Committee on Behavior Analysts is eligible for continuing education credit for maintenance of BACB certification and for Arizona licensure renewal. To claim this credit, make note of the code word provided hourly throughout the meeting. To report the code word to board staff for purposes of earning continuing education credit, look for the link on the board's meeting page for this particular meeting. So Ms. Malice, do we start now with the code word?
No, Madam Chair, we will start in 1 hour at 10:30. Okay. Either I will raise my hand or you can just give me a reminder.
Okay. I didn't know if they needed one at the very beginning. Thank you for that. All right. Moving on to agenda item number four, the approval of minutes from January 6, 2025, regular session minutes.
So what moved. Is,
Madam Chair, just a note that I was not at the meeting, so I won't be voting.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Rates. So Dr. Stenhoff made a motion.
We have a
Ms. Denton has second. Is there any discussion? Cool. Seeing none, all in favor, say aye.
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 Aye. Any opposed? The motion carries. All right. Thanks, friends. With agenda item number five, I am actually recused from this agenda item. So Dr. Stenhoff, thank you so much for being willing to step in to serve as chair. I will be turning off my camera and leaving the room. And then Ms. Michelson, you will send me a text when we're ready to come back. All right, Dr. Stenhoff, thank you very much. And over to you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'll be sharing some important information for those participating today. Please note that a person or representative of a person who has filed or is subject of a complaint and is present today may make a brief statement up to 5 minutes to the committee when prompted by me. The committee may also have questions for the complainant or respondent after the statement. Only individuals directly involved in the complaint, which are the complainant and respondent, may address the committee and make a statement. If the committee wishes to hear from any other party, it will make a request during the case review. For everyone in attendance today, please ensure that your audio remains on mute. When prompted by the committee to speak, the complaint respondents, and if applicable, their legal representative may unmute themselves at that time. Please note that individuals in attendance who speak out without a committee approval will be warned by the acting chair, I suppose me, not to interrupt. If the interruption continues after a second warning, the individual will be removed from the Zoom meeting and not permitted to re-enter the meeting. Please only use initials for patients or children and the complainant. Be aware that the content of many records involved in these complaints is confidential and the content should not be discussed in a public meeting. The committee may go to executive session to discuss any confidential records or to receive confidential legal advice from the board's attorney, Jean Galvin. So today we're going to hear complaint number 25-02 with Amanda Sobis. I'll be providing a brief overview of this case, and then we'll move into some further questions if applicable. Ms. Sobis has been in Arizona LBA since December of 2023. The complainant DH worked the same agency as Ms. Sobis from June to July of 24, at which time she was terminated. DH reports that the termination was due to a false allegation made about her conduct. On the day of termination, DH submitted a complaint against Ms. Sobis alleging that she failed to address client concerns when brought to her attention by DH, inadequately supervised DH, provided insufficient notification of DH of schedule changes, and engaged in multiple relationships with technicians she supervised. 1 month prior to DH's termination, Ms. Sobis tenured a resignation with 1 month's notice and is not currently working, is not working with the current agency. DH reported that a client, MK, arrived at the clinic and showed signs of being sick and not wanting to be there. MK's mother told the front office that if MK cried more than an hour to pick her up, to call and have her come pick her up. MK arrived at 9 a.m. and continued to cry by 10:36 and stopped crying for a few minutes because she had a bottle. MK, who was reported, had a temperature, yet the parent was not informed. DH made attempts the following day on July 2nd to discuss the previous day's events, but they weren't able to discuss. On July 3rd, they discussed the sick policy. Additionally, DH was concerned that another client wasn't ready for ABA therapy, but Ms. Sobis, in fact, did. DH indicated that Ms. Sobis reported that DH should consider another field due to the number of red flags she had. And DH was asked to work with a client she had not seen but wasn't given any information how to conduct the session. Ms. Sobis allegedly violated Section 1.11, multiple relationships of the BACB's code, because she is friends with some of the BTs. DH reported that Ms. Sobis was giving them answers for some of the assessments that they were taking. After DH was terminated, the HR team refused to provide DH with the client tracker for supervision hours. In regard to the licensee's response, Ms. Sobis reported that on the day of MK's fever that she was working remotely, but the supervisor, Cheyenne Carlson, was working at the clinic and checked MK's status. She indicated that her temperature was 99 degrees and appeared bored and wasn't crying. MK's temperature was checked again 30 minutes later and was at 98.5. These were documented in the supplied documentation. Regarding the shift changes, at about 12:33, DH was told by Ms. Carlson and Ms. Sobis that she was ending her shift early because of what was going on, and she left her shift early. On July 8th, DH had a client cancel and was working. It was going to be working with MK. However, DH indicated that she was overwhelmed with being transitioned to MK and could not complete her shift. This was further affirmed by Melanie Avaro, RBO, and lead RBT, who submitted a statement to HR, which is also in the documentation. Regarding the insufficient notification, those pieces address that. Regarding the engagement in multiple relationships, it was reported that that was not actually the case, according to Ms. Silva's response. So this ends my summary. Are there any questions for me?
No questions.
Okay, thank you. DH, are you present today? I think I saw your initials on there.
Yes, I am.
Okay, so if you would just go ahead and remain unmuted and state your full name, or excuse me, give me your initials for the record. This is your opportunity to make a brief statement, up to 5 minutes, and the committee may have some questions for you following your
statement. Over. The statement alone was that MK, the student that we were working with, she was told from the very, well, we were told from the very beginning by her mom itself that if she was crying more than an hour, mom will be more than happy to come pick her up because she knows that MK was not feeling well that morning. As far as the temperature wise, documented, it does say that it was 100.1, which is definitely a fever at that point. So they lowered the temperature on their end to make her stay. She was crying for about 3 hours straight. And the only time that she stopped crying is when they gave her a bottle, which, I mean, any kid would stop crying at that point itself. I did reach out to Cheyenne as well with my concerns because I was listening and watching the child for that entire time. And she was in her office and did not go check on the child until she was given a bottle. So I can see where she was like, well, the time I checked, like she wasn't crying, but that's because she was eating. I did reach out to Amanda as well, and I let her know, even though Amanda was working from home, and she said that Cheyenne was handling it. And I expressed my concerns with that and letting her know that, like, she was not checking on her the way that she was coming and approaching that she was, that I've been watching this member for the last couple of hours, and that's not what happened. Then when I did bring up another member that I felt like was not ready to start services, it was talked about in a prior meeting that we had clinical wise that he was crying every single time that he was coming in. And when he did come in, he would isolate in his room for pretty much the entire ABA time that we had him. So the fact that he wasn't doing anything and he wasn't able to follow his treatment plan, it was just becoming overwhelming and essentially like not making the child feel welcome. As far as when I did talk to Amanda about the sick policy itself, we had multiple people in the office with COVID, as well as we know that COVID not always showed the symptoms. So someone can be tested positive for COVID and not have the symptoms. But these kids that were coming in were showing symptoms, were going through the stuffy nose, the running leaky nose, the cough, the fevers. And it was just becoming like a cycle thing. And we weren't being on top of that. So that was like a huge concern because some of the kids did have other health conditions that COVID could affect, which one kid did have a seizure. I'm not sure exactly what the outcome of that was, but I know mom ended up stop bringing that child. So that alone shows that like it was not being followed properly. And then when I did talk to Amanda about it and she was like, well, I don't believe that this field might be for you. Like, have you really thought about what you want out of this field? And I believe in the AB or the ethics, the code of ethics, it does state in there that BCBAs are not supposed to essentially downplay. They're supposed to motivate and help people that want to be in this field. So that was definitely very concerning because I brought up concerns and they were just pretty much dismissed. And then concerning right after I brought everything up, she put in her 2 weeks to get out of there. That kind of just showed that they weren't doing what they were supposed to be doing and kind of like retaliated me on being able to speak up. As far as Ms. Sobis having personal relationships, that was a thing. I was actually sitting next to her when she was doing a assessment for the ABA certification, and she was giving the girl hinted answers. Like, it wasn't obviously like straightforward word for word, but giving the hidden answers because she wanted her to get certified due to their personal relation. Outside of that, I believe I went over everything. The one shift I did end up leaving early because my blood pressure, I mean, my heart rate went like extremely up because of how upset I was getting due to Cheyenne and Amanda both feeling like I was feeling like they were not worried about the child's need and just worried about the child being there so we can get paid for it. Which definitely was a hot topic with a lot of the RBTs that were there as well. That's why most of them left. But I did not refuse to work with the other kid the day after. It was asking her a question about what happened about the day prior. And then when she went to HR, she said that I was like aggressive and all these things, but that was not the case either, which there was multiple people in that office when she came in and I was just being open to her about like what would benefit out of this. And it was just kind of shut down and she walked away. But I think that was everything that I had here from the relation, communication, sick policy. Yeah, that would be the overall aspect of it.
All right. Thank you, Dage. Is there any questions from the committee for DH?
I have a couple of questions.
Of course.
Ms. Den?
What I was interested in finding out, I tried to look through all of the documentation that the committee receives, which includes a variety of documents in addition to just the complaint that was submitted by you. And it includes like some of the treatment plans and the session notes. It includes some other, confidential health information of the clients, right? And so I don't want you to share any confidential information about the clients by any means. But can you talk to me a little bit about the support that you received before you would work with a client? So perhaps like training that was given by the agency, looking at, there was some conversations that went on in the complaint and some, like screenshots of conversations between team members at the time. And, what I'm just interested in knowing is, how prepared were you to serve a client that you hadn't seen before?
As far as training with the therapy group of Tucson itself, I did not get any training, in a sense of like one-on-one. I was pretty much put in front of a computer and told to like watch all these videos. I did do like the 40-hour RBT class as well. But that was like a given, but outside of that, it was pretty much like a whole bunch of slideshows that we had to go through. And then we would have to go see, do like a side-by-side with another, RBT and their client to kind of see like how they run things. But that was only, I want to say maybe 2 days before they were like, here are your clients. And then I only had one supervision for the month and a half that I was there, which was very brief. And we never went over like what happened during that session or what she's seen or what I can do better with. It was just kind of like, okay, have a good day.
Okay. So there was document supplied that showed supervision, and I'll save some of those questions a little bit for Ms. Sobis. but looking at that, can you explain kind of the discrepancy that you see between you receiving one instance of supervision and what's been documented has been 16% of your cases? I think it was five different supervisions occurred.
I only had one, so I'm not quite sure where the other ones came through.
Okay.
I have no idea because I only sat with Amanda one time with one of my clients.
Did you sit with any other BCBAs?
No, ma'am.
Okay. Those are the questions that I had.
Thank you.
Other questions from committee members?
Mr. Chair, or I'm Chair, and then Dr. Stenhoff. I just wanted to know for the record that I arrived after your summary and while DH was making her statement, and that I'm ready to fully participate. Thank you.
I also arrived late. Sorry.
Dr. Davey, I'm officially no longer Madam Chair, so it's just Mr. Chair.
Any further questions from committee members this time? All right, Ms. Sobis, I noted you're here as well, so would you please unmute yourself, state your name for the record, and I'm going to pause for just one moment. DH, we may have further questions for you as we continue, but back to Ms. Sobis. So if you please state your full name for the record, this is your opportunity to make a brief statement up to 5 minutes, and the committee may have further questions for you.
My name is Amanda Sobis. And I appreciate the opportunity to address the concerns raised and provide clarification regarding the events described. In my response, I have provided a detailed account of the events in question, supported by relevant exhibits, including communications, supervisor reports, and policy guidelines. I have outlined my actions in accordance with company policies, ethical standards, and I believe these actions were taken in best interest of our clients, their well-being, and the effective operation of the team. I respectfully maintain that decisions made, particularly regarding the care and supervision of clients, were based on professional judgment, company protocols, and the input of my supervisor. Furthermore, I have demonstrated my commitment to addressing Ms. DH's concerns and fostering open communication as evidenced in the attached exhibits. I trust the information provided will allow for a fair and comprehensive evaluation of the situation. Thanks for your time for consideration, and I'm happy to answer any questions regarding the provided exhibits.
All right, thank you, Ms. Elvis. Many members, any questions for Ms. Elvis?
I'm just going to kick off the questions apparently for everything. Maybe it's just that I miss talking as part of being a chairwoman. I don't know. Anywho, with that being said, thank you, Ms. Sovis, for your statement. You know, there was a lot of documentation to review as we were looking through things. And I'm going to kind of stay on a little bit of the line of questions that I started with DH. From your understanding and what you engaged in, can you talk a little bit about the level of support that was offered to DH or other behavior technicians who were in the same position at the same time to prepare them for handling challenging clients?
Yes. So all of our technicians go through a 2-week training period. The first week, they finish they work on watching modules and things like that for half the day. And the second half of the day is shadowing sessions with the lead RBTs. And then the second week, they start leading the session and the lead RBT is shadowing them and watching how they're implementing goals and giving feedback on that. There is also check-ins with their assigned BCBA through that week just to sit down and go over each client and their treatment plan. She was assigned to my clients, which were 7 clients. So we went over those 7 behavior plans, those 7 treatment plans, and going over their goals. And those were the clients. Yes.
Sorry, can I pause you for a second?
Yeah. Because
I feel like you're going to tell me so much more information and I don't
Sorry.
Want to forget. So as you talk about the review of the behavior plans.
Yes.
Can you confirm that the client, hold on, let me make sure I get the initials right here. Dun, 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 dun. Starts with a G. Last name is eluding me.
B.
GB.
Yes.
This client here had a behavior plan, right? I see the behavior yes. plan in the treatment plan that was written. I see the data that were collected. I see the decreasing trend across a good chunk of time there. It looks like it's from November of 2023 until June of 2024. And there were behavior reduction goals for physical aggression. With that, all of that information, can you confirm that DH was in fact trained on this behavior plan?
Yes, she was.
Okay. What did that training look like?
I went over the behavior plans with her, sitting down in my office. I went, and then when she is shadowing with the lead RBT, it is reviewed, with the lead RBT when she is shadowing.
Okay. I think the follow-up question that I would have there is what supports are available to behavior technicians if they're assigned to a novel client? right? I've never worked with you before. I'm nervous. Something, I don't know what's going to go on. I've got an hour's notice. I've got 6 hours notice, you know, whatever that might be. What supports are available to ensure that the client who is receiving the services from a novel RBT is receiving the treatment plan directed services?
So we shadowed all of the kids on her team when she was training. So she went and shadowed all the kids. The client that she referred to that she did not have training on was not on my team. So it was not somebody she shadowed with. But the BCBA was going to provide supervision for that training, and I had let her know, and that's documented in my exhibit, that the BCBA was going to provide supervision to support her with that new client she had not shadowed with.
Okay. I'll pause on my questions to see if any other committee members have questions. I'll reserve some of my other questions for a little bit later.
Yeah. Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Dr. Davey.
So thank you for being here, Amanda Sobis, and thank you also, DH, for being present. So my question is just around this discrepancy, right? Like to hear the complainant discuss supervision, there was a significant lack of the supervision. You've clearly provided documentation of said supervision, which I'm assuming goes in part with reporting back to the BACB. How do you explain this kind of misinterpretation of what appears to be some extensive periods of time of supervision, you know, 200 minutes or something to that effect of supervision? Can you walk me through how an RBT could misinterpret that or might have misinterpreted that?
I am not sure. This was the exhibits that I provided was her tracker. That she tracked her own supervision. So I'm not quite sure. One of them was a... Oh,
could I just stop you there? So to be clear, that document was completed by DH?
Correct, yes.
Okay.
The only thing I was going to add is that one of the supervisions was a group supervision, and that is documented in the exhibit. So it was with other technicians as well.
Okay. And then my other question, again, kind of along this line of communication and making sure people know what's going on, off the supervision piece, but onto the discussion of whether or not a child was in distress, whether, you know, on the day where we have text messages back and forth with you discussing with people that are on site with regard to a client that had a slight fever and then that fever was dropping. You know, there seems to be a lot of communication going on between you and, sorry, I forget the other person, but I'll pull up my notes, the other individual that was on site. Just in general, for you as a BCBA and for the agency, how is that information being conveyed to your direct line staff, right? Like, how is the fact that you guys are involved in those kinds of things and working behind the scenes, how is that happening today? And, you know, based on kind of reading through the complaint which you received, have you made any adjustments based on some of the information that was contained in the initial complaint?
So I just want to clarify, I no longer work at that company. So changes today apply.
Well, you can actually tell me then about changes that you personally, as a BCBA, as a licensee, that you put in place based that may have occurred after reading some of that information where the complainant feels like they did not have all the accurate information and it was not being relayed down to them.
Okay. Yeah. So just increasing communication, making sure that everyone is aware of what is happening and increasing the communication as best as possible, whether that be messages, emails, phone calls, if I'm not currently in contact with them in person, or just having as many check-ins in person like I would in the clinic. Sorry, there was another part to your question. I feel like I messed apart.
No, I think that it was around the communication piece, right? It was like, okay. you know, how was that information? Like, what do you take away from DH's perspective that things were not happening, that there was this perception that the child's best interests were not in place? And yet at the same time, you know, on the side, you and what I assume to be another supervising BCBA are working through the process and are clearly trying to handle the situation. And so I was just interested to know, like, how you personally now as a licensed behavior analyst view this idea of making sure that the team's aware of what's going on, so that there does not seem to be, you know, does not appear to be this you know, us versus them mentality that kind of came out in some of the complaint.
Okay. Yes. Just increasing communication, making sure everybody understands what we are doing behind the scenes, that we are always looking at the client's best interest in all areas, and making sure that communication is communicated to all relevant parties.
And in your current role, are those practices you have in place?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Other questions from the committee members?
Okay, I was offering the floor to other people. So, the question, I'm going to kind of shift over to another area of the complaint. You know, Dr. Stenhoff, Mr. Chair, reviewed the overall gist of things, a summary. And one of the things that was mentioned was DH's concern about your engagement in multiple relationships. Specifically, there was the comment that during an RBT competency assessment that answers were being fed to the individual who was going through that competency assessment. You supplied a response that showed that, yes, you did supply those answers, but that was not during the competency assessment that you signed off on, but you then came back and provided an additional competency check for that RBT competency assessment to ensure that they could independently engage in the tasks identified in that RBT competency assessment. And the RBT supplied a statement as well, as far as like kind of coming back with that. Can you, I really should have thought about my question before I asked it, so it'd come out fluently and articulated. With the relationships that you have with behavior technicians, particularly the way that you conduct your competency assessments to help them either become an RBT or to certify as an RBT, can you talk about that process, what it looks like for you, and how you support your technicians through that?
Yeah, absolutely. So I have given numerous competency assessments to people who are trying to become RBTs. Often the individuals that I give the competency assessment do not meet the criteria the first time that I give the competency assessment. I still go through the whole thing, even if they haven't met a certain criteria, just so they are able to demonstrate each area. We can go through where they need to get more competent in. So if they don't meet a criteria, I will let them know right there, oh, you missed this part. You need, this is the answer I was looking for. This is how I was hoping you would demonstrate this. And then I continue on. So I have done that for numerous competency assessments. And then I let them know, hey, let's get back together next week. I'll check in, see if you're ready. Let's try this competency assessment again.
Okay. Are there any other situations that you can think of that might have led to the perception that you had multiple relationships with RBTs under your supervision?
I mean, I'm friendly with technicians. But there have never been an overstepping of having a dual relationship with technicians.
Okay, thank you.
Any further questions? I'd like to make a motion to go to executive session for legal advice.
I will second that.
All right. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Okay. Motion carries. Ms. Solvis, I had a further question for you. You indicated in the documentation that Ms. Carlson was providing some supervision or overseeing the clinic while you're working remotely. Could you characterize that supervision or operationalized supervision of what was going on at the clinic?
She was there as a supervisor. If RBTs needed assistance, she was not providing any behavior analytic services to any clients. She was just there to support the clinic as needed.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes.
Can I dig into that a little bit deeper for just a second? When you say support an RBT, can you give an example of what that support might look like?
I'm just trying to think of what people would come to her about.
Yeah.
Scheduling things, taking time off. She was approving all technicians' schedules and time off as needed. Trying to think of what other support she was giving. I think that was about it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can I ask the question a little bit differently, Mr. Chair? Was this clinical oversight or administrative oversight?
Administrative oversight.
Thank you.
Yes.
Are there any further questions from committee members to DEH or Ms. Sovis? Okay. All right, so the committee will now begin their...
I have one other question.
Yeah, Dr. Davey.
I have one other question back to DH. With regard to this supervision tracker, do you recall completing this revision, supervision tracker the licensee Ms. Sobis is referring to?
For tracking my hours, yes. But as far as like the clinical supervision part, the hours that were included in that was like a... overall clinical when it was like a big group of people, not one-on-ones. So I think that's where a little bit of the confusion comes from, because I only had one-on-one supervision versus the clinicals we have with everyone, because that was documented as well. But then when I asked for that with the company, they refused to. So I can't even confirm or deny what's there without seeing it.
But there, you are aware of that tracker. You are aware that there is group supervision in there, and then you're, from what I'm hearing, you say that there should be at least one, perhaps one-on-one meeting in there. So
yes,
your best of your recollection. All right, I appreciate that. Thank you.
Of course.
Any other questions? Okay. The committee will now begin their deliberation. This is a time for the committee members to discuss the case among themselves without interruptions from complainants, licensees. Would anybody like to begin, or I can kick it off if you like. Okay, I'll kick it off then. So in my review of the records, you know, obviously the complaint was, you know, there were some charges in there that were fairly, I'd say, serious or concerning to an extent. But as I further examined the records that were provided, it appeared that there was support that the complaint was being supervised according to the tracker. That when the individual or the when MK was ill, that the temperature was being checked, and we have documentation of that in those text messages. As far as the multiple relationship of, you know, feeding the answer allegation, Ms. Sobis addressed that and kind of indicated a teaching technique that that's, you know, fairly well used, I think, in the field. And so my concerns in regard to that were alleviated. And so I guess I'm just going to go ahead and we can have further discussion, but I'd like to make a motion that we dismiss this case. I don't see that it rises to the occasion for recommendation of the board, but I'd like to make a motion to dismiss this case or make a recommendation to the board that they dismiss this case at this time.
I'll second that.
Okay. All right. Do we have further discussion?
I'll just add in, you know, in the discussion piece that I agree that the concerns that were presented, you know, were addressed in the documentation that was supplied. I would say, you know, Ms. Sobis, you did a nice job of documenting and supplying things. And so, you know, as we look at this and we talk about the fact that this committee and the overall board is designed to protect those who receive behavior analytics services, you know, and it was refreshing to me to see that, for example, there were temperature checks, you know, there was the, hey, can you go check in on this person? It's atypical for them to be crying for this long, right? And that communication was going on, particularly for, you know, our sweet little bitty kiddos who are receiving our services. And so I want to hear RBT's concerns. I want to hear whenever people come forth and they say this is going on. And I want to be able to see that response and see that people are that licensees are engaging in practices that support the members that are served. So with that, I will agree that I don't believe that any of the concerns were not remediated in the documentation that was supplied, or that it rises to the level of a statutory violation.
All right. Any further discussion?
Mr. Chair,
thank you, Dr. Aides. Go ahead.
Yeah, just quickly, I would agree with everything that's been said by my fellow committee members. The only thing I might add is just the importance of ensuring that our RBTs also understand the policies related to the individuals that we serve, and ensuring that they have access to view that and understanding what are those policies when it comes to clients being ill and how we communicate and how we support our clients. And just wanted to make that for the record, how important that is so that everyone's on the same page. Should these things arise?
And I'm going to add just one more thing. And I this is for DH, and Ms. Dent made this point, and I want to also underscore that if things are concerning, we appreciate the complaints being filed, you know, if done properly. And so that is an important thing, and this is not to discourage that. This is to, I mean, commend that we did it, but this is also part of that vetting process and adjudicating the issues that happened. And then Ms. Sobis, also the documentation provided as well was very helpful as we went through the case as well. So any further discussion? Okay, all in favor of the motion to recommend to the board for dismissal, say aye.
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 Aye. Aye. Opposed? Okay, motion carries. All right, thank you. And Ms. Pakkinen, is Madam Chair back at this point?
Not seeing her enter the waiting room. Let's give her a moment.
I just messaged her right now.
I don't think there's any harm in giving a code word in the meantime. It's a little early, but.
The code word is Barrett, B-A-R-R-E-T-T, Barrett.
Thank you.
everyone. All right. Dr. Stenhoff, thank you for covering in my absence. Are we ready to move on to agenda item number 6?
Madam Chair, yes, thank you. And thanks for the opportunity. And then on that, since we're moving to item number 6, I have a few disclosures to make for the set we have here. So this is going across different groups of applicants. So Fernie Romo, Miss Lee Venezuela, Carrie Hone, Savannah Coons, all were students of mine during their master's program. So I just wanted to disclose that, but I also feel that I can be part of the review process without bias.
Perfect. Any other accusals or notifications anyone needs to make? All right, then we will move on to agenda item number 6, which is why I'm sure most folks are here, because we will do a discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding recommendation to the board pertaining to approval of behavior analyst applicants. Dr. Davey, you're up with applicants 1 through 6, please.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. So I'm going to pick around a little bit on the application. So I'd like to first move that 6A1, Jordan Davis, 6A3, Fernie Romo, and 6A5, Zachary Munson, and 6A6, David Villaray. I'd like to move on them. I'd like to move on them that following my review of the files, including the applicant's education, supervised experience, examination, performance, and declaration, I find those applications to be both administratively and substantively complete.
Dr. Davey, sorry to interrupt you, but before you go on, with Zachary Munson's, and again, this may be my naivety of being not on the committee for such a long time, I did see the notation in there that there was some additional folks on the supervision form that we don't have any supervised hours for. I wasn't sure if that's something that's happened in the past, and we've already deemed that to not be an issue. And also, he does have listed under his employment that he is a BCBA Action Behavior Centers, and his address is listed as Arizona. So, Mr. Munson, since you're on the call as well, if you could speak to both those issues, please.
Yes. So I worked in a group home during my supervision. We had about 7 BCBAs hired to supervise. They were listed under like people who could provide supervision for me. I only received supervision from 2 of those providers, Michael Hitchcock, who was the clinical director, and then Joseph Priestley, who was another BCBA working for them. So everybody else I did not receive supervision from. I just had the opportunity to receive the supervision from Joe Priestley. I believe only Michael Hitchcock signed off on my verification form, my monthly supervision forms. And then he is the one that signed off on my final verification form. I do have those verification form if there is any questions about who signed my monthly contract. And I'm sorry, the second question was?
You're listed on your employment record. It says that you're a BCBA Action Behavior Center.
Yes,
and
yes.
So since you're not licensed yet, if you kind of just speak to what does the nature of your role look like there? Are you being supervised? Do you have a contract in place?
Yes. Yeah, so I have a supervision contract with our clinical director. I've been a BCBA for a few years at this point. So I am doing, and New Jersey does or did not require a license until this year. So I came in unlicensed. I was supervised by Julie Daniel, who is a licensed behavior analyst. Then I was supervised by Doug Hatfield, who is a licensed behavior analyst in Arizona. And currently I'm being supervised by Kelsey Anderson, who is our clinical director currently. And she is a licensed behavior analyst as well. And I do have verification for all that as well to show that I'm providing. So I am providing services. I'm writing behavior plans. I just have Kelsey as my licensed behavior analyst, who's also signing off on those documents for insurance and billing just for that oversight.
Perfect. Thank you so much.
Yeah, sure.
Appreciate you being here. And sorry, Dr. Davey, to interrupt you.
No, it's fine. Just so you know my rationale behind it, like I'd read through the information around Ms. Billings' BCBA number, and that to me was sufficient with regard to it. The other supervision pieces were there. I did not note the BCBA piece, and so thank you for asking that question. And then I guess I'll just also add to the disclosure that I did not know Mr. Munson, but I am also employed by that same agency. But have no direct contact with any of the clinical teams in the state of Arizona. All right. Moving on to, back to my list here. Hold on one second. Let's jump to Jamila. I'm going to say this probably wrong, but we're going to go with Chiki. I don't know. There's a lot of there. So if she's there, I'm more than happy to correct that and the pronunciation of her last name and apologize for that in advance. In reviewing the documentation, this is another one that I feel that there's no reason to hold this up. The application is complete and is in terms of what was provided to us. However, there is a supervisor who has been unresponsive to this particular applicant. And I would like to see that that supervisor is referred to the BACB under BACB Ethics Code 1.15, which is responding to requests. Behavior analysts make appropriate efforts to respond to requests for information from and comply with deadlines to relevant individuals. That's supervisees and trainees and entities such as ourselves. And there's failure there to comply. And therefore, this applicant had to do extraordinary efforts to make sure that their application could be seen, and then therefore to move forward to the full board for approval.
I see Ms. Takanon has her hand raised.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Davey, would you state for the record the name of the BCBA that we are going to recommend to the board be referred to the BACB?
I'm going to try to pronounce it. So to the best of my ability, it is Sharveya Sangala.
Thank you.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, one more. And I'm going to stick to the theme here. This is for application 6A4, Shauna Paul. Shauna Paul's situation is the same, trying to reach out to a supervisor. Her application is complete. She attempted to reach out, got nothing back from the supervisor, and has conveyed that information back to board staff and has put together, you know, their experience verification forms and various other pieces of information to be able to move forward. However, there is the issue with one of the supervisors failing to provide timely information. So again, referral to the BACB, and that is through BACB Ethics Code 1.115 or 1.15, responding to requests, as I've already mentioned. And the BCBA in question there, I'm getting the wheel of death on my very large PDF files. Z, do you have the name of the individual that they were working on that the text messages applied for and then the verification forms? I'm getting the wheel of death.
Dr. Davey, I can look that up. I do have that information, but I have to look in my files to see specifically who that is.
Is it Taylor Heinzen?
I can't scroll right now, but it was the individual in California, not the individual in Hawaii. And I can't remember who was who.
I see someone in the gallery, John Doe, with their hand raised. Are you the applicant in question right now?
Yes, ma'am.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to confirm that it is Taylor Heinzen in California.
Thank you. Thank you for that. Yes. I apologize for my wheel of death, but I think the complaint file that was several hundred pages is chewing up some memory on the backside. I'm going to close that right now. Thank you, Madam Chair. That concludes my review of the applications that I was assigned lead on. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Dr. Davey. Next, we have Dr. Rates looking at applicants number 7 through 14.
Yes, before I get started, I'd like to make a motion to move to executive session for legal advice.
Second.
Dr. Senev, or Ms., sorry, Dr. Rates has made a motion. Dr. Senev has seconded the motion. All in favor? Is that right now? Okay. All in favor, say aye.
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 Any opposed? Nay. Motion passes. Buddy back. Dr. Rates, are you ready to continue with your list?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. I will go through my list in a few different groups, similar to Dr. Davey. To start, applicant number 6A7, Aubrey Nielsen. Applicant number 6A11, Ariel Nicora. Applicant 6A10. I'm sorry, applicant 13, Anna Rusiski. I apologize if I am not pronouncing your last names correctly. Please forgive me. And applicant number 9, Michael Doran. In my review of the file, including the applicant's education, supervision, experience, exam performance, and declarations, find it to be both administratively and substantively complete, and I would recommend that they move forward to the full board. For three applicants, I just have a couple little administrative notes to make. I still believe that they can move forward, but want to make a note on the record. For applicant number 10, it just indicates that there is licensure in Idaho and that there is not. So I think that's just an error. They've added their BACB certification number there. And then for another applicant, they indicated that they hold a license in Oregon. They have put Arizona in the front and then put Oregon. Additionally, that license has also expired. So again, just some administrative issues there. Everything else was submitted and we see that that license is expired, but was submitted. So again, believe it can move forward, but just a couple administrative notes there. And then for applicant number 8, the application was complete. I don't know if the applicant is on the line. This is for, let me make sure that I say their name correctly. Nizali Valenzuela, is he here?
Yes, I'm here.
I just wanted to confirm, you also indicated that your role changed to a board certified behavior analyst in September of 2024. You were not licensed yet. Are you currently receiving supervision?
Yes.
Or service? Can you describe that for us?
Yes. So I work for Action Behavior Centers and I am receiving supervision from our clinical director, Melissa Hancock. So my role here is, it's titled applicant BCBA. So I'm still receiving supervision. We meet every week and we log all the information that we talk about.
Wonderful. Thank you for being here and clarifying that. That allows us to move things forward. So with that, I would recommend that this application also move forward to the full board for review. I have one final application that I just wanted to make a note. The supervision final verification from the BACB was submitted. We had confirmation that it was submitted by the licensee's supervisor, but when we reached out, we didn't get any follow-up. It's the form that was used to complete their certification application. It is completed in full. So I just wanted to note that we couldn't get back in touch with them, but I still think given that we have that form and everything else was complete, we should go ahead and move that forward. But wanted to make a note for the record and certainly open if other committee members feel differently.
Dr. Reitz, I don't have a problem with the verification form, but I do know there was an issue with the transcripts. I know that Ms. Malice wasn't able to open them. So it's my understanding, Ms. Malice can correct me, but I don't think we have transcripts right now.
I think they submitted their transcripts on their own.
Yes, Madam Chair, the transcripts were submitted by the applicant.
Okay. So I guess just again, new to the circus here. Is that something that we've allowed in the past for applicants to submit their own as opposed to it being from their university, or either electronically or via snail mail?
Look, for our fellow committee members, I do believe when we've had issues accessing them, that has been.
Okay.
But if fellow committee members see that differently, please let me know. We're looking at page 5 of the application for those that are reviewing.
I guess I'm just looking for precedent. I haven't been around as long as everybody else. So if we've done it before, I'm cool with it. I just want to make sure we're being equal.
I don't know that we've had a situation where we couldn't get transcripts from a university. Like the closest thing that we had was a few months ago where there was an applicant who completed their degree in, I want to say it was Jerusalem. And there was an issue there, but the transcripts ended up coming through because the university reopened during a time of peace instead of war. But I can't think of precedent.
Board staff, you've been around longer than I have. Ms. Pacanon, do you know if there's been instances in the past?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Our rules and statutes allow us to take the application on the whole and the materials that are provided and the efforts of the applicant to be able to make decisions, to be able to go ahead and grant the license. If the committee is of the feeling as such that, or the belief of such that all roads have been exhausted to be able to gain those transcripts, and it is the university that is being at fault and not some other issue, then I believe that we have the ability to move that application forward based on previous precedent.
Okay.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I think what Dr. Davey is describing is precedent that precedes me, certainly precedes Zakiya. So we don't have, you know, the longitudinal memory that Dr. Davey has. So I would defer to his recollection of applications with similar circumstances.
I'm not that old, and I would just say, Madam Chair, your board staff should, like, we've done this before when we couldn't get the verification form, right? Like, but we can see it in different other ways that this individual has, you know, met the qualifications. In this case, the transcript, like one could assume by connecting the dots that their transcript at some point did make its way to the BACB to be seen appropriate to be able to sit for the exam. And so there's other extenuating circumstances that we can take into consideration. I see them as Govan. If she has anything to add to that, be happy to hear from her as well, but I believe that's kind of where we would land.
Yes, Ms. Galvin probably needs the question re-articulated so that she's adequately prepared.
I apologize. I had to take a comfort break.
Oh, no problem. Madam Chair, I'm happy to re-
I'm sorry.
If that's appropriate. So the question, Ms. Galvin, is around this. There's an applicant that cannot secure their transcripts from the university. And we were having the discussion that the committee can take the application on the whole and extenuating circumstances and go ahead and move the application forward if they believe the applicant has done all they can in their power to try to secure the critical information that's needed For licensure. And I brought up just some other areas or other precedents that we had put in place where we could not get verification forms, where we could not get access to supervision logs. However, the application on the whole gave us enough information to feel confident about moving forward around the individual's qualifications.
Yeah, and I would just add that they did submit it themselves. It's just not coming directly from the university.
Oh, okay. That is an important detail. And then, so I would, if you believe that that is enough information, then you could proceed. You do have the transcripts. It just didn't come directly from the university.
And, this is not the case that the applicant just sent it in as part of the packet. The applicant cannot get the university to push it through.
Correct. Yes.
Okay. Very good.
All right. Thank you, everyone. Dr. Raitt, sorry for taking forever.
I appreciate the added conversation, and that's why I had it listed separate. So
okay.
Thank you to my fellow committee members.
All right. And that's your list, yeah?
That's everyone.
All right. So I'm up next with applicants 15 to 22. I'm going to start with my clean list, which is actually quite long, which is great. Applicant 6A15, Kristen Burris. Applicant 6A16, Von Trace Jones. Again, sorry everyone for my failure to learn phonics. Applicant 6A18, Gabriella Filarino Romo. Applicant 6A20, Jenny Nguyen. Sorry. Applicant 6A21, Rosa Padilla. Applicant 6A22, Jennifer McGee. My review of these applicants, including the applicant's education, supervised experience, examination performance, and declarations, I found it to be both administratively and substantively complete, and I recommend that they be moved to the board for review. Just two that I need to review. The first one being applicant 17, Carly Durante. I've not had one of these before where there has been a declaration of being terminated. And so I would ask my fellow committee members or board staff to just walk me through what we typically do in one of these cases.
Madam Chair, do you want me to sort of start the in part answer the question? So anytime there's a disclosure, a declaration, it's appropriate for the committee members to invite the applicant if present to address questions relative to, the information that was supplied. If you feel the information doesn't supply you with the entirety of what you would need to know to send the application forward, it would be, great to answer questions, ideal to have your questions answered. A fair might also be warranted if there's, perhaps documentation to help, present a full understanding of the event that the applicant described.
Okay. Thank you for that, Ms. Pakanon. I don't see concerns given what the applicant wrote kind of in their response to what happened surrounding termination. Committee members, it's on page 3 of the application if anyone wants to take a look. I wasn't concerned with the circumstances which termination happened. I just never had one before and I didn't want to just pass it through without asking question, doing due diligence. So as other committee members want to have discussion, I'm also happy to push this to the board for approval.
I would agree with your assessment, Dr. Ben.
Okay. All right. And then last one for me is applicant number 19. Robin Nuss. This is a situation where one of her supervisors is refusing to sign the verification forms because it's been let's see, it was from 13 years ago, and the supervisor says she doesn't have those records anymore and is therefore refused to sign. But as Dr. Davey mentioned, if we take applicant 14, at some point it was signed to be able to sit for the BACB exam. I mean, in truth, I don't know if I would have records from 13 years ago either. So I don't want to delay her from being able to apply because their supervisor won't cooperate. But I just wanted to bring it to my fellow committee members on what to do, because without that signature, then it's not enough hours.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I would just say, I mean, we're looking well beyond the 7 years required to keep documentation, yeah, both at the BAC level as well as the statutes within Arizona state law. It is interesting that the supervisor just wouldn't attest and say, yeah, you know, I don't have the records, I'm sorry, you know, but this did happen, versus the response we got. But again, I look at the application on the whole, and I don't know that I want to hold up an application that is complete with that, without, you know, for just that one reason, that is no fault of the person that's put the application forward. And again, we have other cooperating evidence that this individual is qualified in the state of Arizona.
Any other committee members have reservations about moving this application? Okay, I'm seeing no's, so I said shake. So it'd then be my recommendation that this application also be moved to the board for full approval. All right. Moving on, we have Ms. Denton to review applicants 23 to 29.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the applications that are going to move forward on my clean list include applicant, let me get the numbers correct here. Applicant number 25, Drew Mercer. This was one that was coming back from a fair. The appropriate information was supplied. As a result, it's moving forward to my clean list. Additionally, applicant number Raina Sadri, which is applicant number 28, and applicant number 29, Bridget Beltran Perez. In my review of these applications and their files, including their education, supervised experience, examination performance, and declarations, I find them to be both administratively and substantively complete. So that's the first batch here. I've got some questions, and I am happy to see that there are some of these individuals who are on the call today. So with this, the first one is applicant number 23, Tiffany Poach. Is she on the call today?
I am.
Hi, Tiffany. As reviewing your application, everything looks to be in order. I just wanted to confirm. I see that you're working for CAIO. And I wanted to see, are you working as a BCBA for CAIO in Arizona?
So I work for CAIO in Colorado. Okay. However, we do provide some telehealth cases as well, and they do have cases in Arizona. So I've not provided any services in Arizona up until this point.
Okay, but you have not?
No.
Okay. All right. Well, Ms. Poach now moves to my clean list as well. The other one that I have that very well may be the same situation here, just wanting to confirm, is applicant number 26, Savannah Kuntz. I also see that she is on the line. You've even shown your face and you've unmuted. Here we go. Question here for you is, mm-hmm. you know, in reviewing your employment information and your supervised experience, mm-hmm. I just had a question here. Your supervision experience ended in July of 2024, based off of the documents that you provided.
Yes.
And your employment record does not show anything about, doesn't show anything about employment post July 2024. Have you been working at the Bisto Center since July of 2024, or have you been, is your employment record accurate that there's been no employment?
No, so I'm still working at the Bisto Center. Right now I'm an assistant clinical director, so our assistant clinical supervisor. So I'm working underneath of those BCBs still kind of providing me that supervision.
Okay. Can you explain kind of what that supervision looks like, and were the supervisors who are overseeing you in that role licensed in the state of Arizona?
Yeah. So currently right now I'm working on some cases that are supervised by that BCBA. So, and we meet weekly, and a lot of my overlaps are with the BCBA, and we're doing them at the same time. I am not billing, they are billing. And then we're just meeting and chatting about it.
All right. With that information said, do we need an updated employment information in this just to make it complete? I have no concerns about the application moving forward. You know, it appears to be, you know, the supervised experience meets our requirements, their education meets our requirements, their examination performance. It's just the matter of there is a missing gap of employment on there where the applicant was engaging in behavior analytic practice.
I think you can ask her to submit that information, but I don't believe the approval of the application is dependent upon that, if she's willing to do that.
Okay.
Yep, for sure.
Wonderful. Yeah, so if you'll just submit that, then Ms. Kuntz now also moves to my clean list. Okay, there is a question that I have here for applicant number 24. Applicant number 24 is Misty Saracino.
Maybe? Yes.
That's how I pronounce it?
Yes. Wonderful.
Did I get it right?
You did, yes.
Dog. Okay, wonderful. As I am looking at your application, I have some questions.
Yes.
You have listed several supervisors that have Arizona licenses who provided your supervision. Specifically here, we have Alexandra Zachary. You noted that her start date of your supervision was August 10th of 2020, but she did not obtain her Arizona license until July 7th of 2023. We also have Lindsay Osborne, who you have listed as starting your supervised experience on August 10th of 2020, that did not obtain her Arizona license until October 7th of 2022. Myesha Arguelles.
Arguelles. Arguelles.
Thank you. Yes. I got your name right. I give myself some grace. It shows that she started your supervision on August 10th of 2020, but she didn't have an Arizona license until March 1st of 2021. Evelyn Hawley, same thing, August 10th of 2020, didn't have an Arizona license until July 28th of 2021. And then Sonia Tim, her licensure date was November 19th of 2020, and you said that she started on August 10th of 2020. So I bring up all of this because the people who supervise you have to be licensed at the time of supervision. And I wondered if perhaps you just put the start date of your entire supervision experience for every single supervisor rather than the date that they actually started supervising you.
That is correct. And we actually did a deep dive of that once we found out, and we actually listed each one of their start dates on one of the trackers with Miss Casey Russ at one time. So I don't know which tracker you're looking at, but we were.
I don't have your supervision tracker. What I do have is whenever you submit to the board, your application for licensure, there is a form that is called the, I don't have the title of it anymore. Board staff, correct
it's
me if
the
I'm wrong.
Supervised experience requirements form. That's how it comes up on our screen.
Okay.
I listed all of them because they were all employed under Centria. And so that's all those supervisors that supervised me. Okay. But they all weren't starting, of course, in August of 2020.
Okay. All right. So what I am going to propose here is a first additional information request be sent to gather the details that you say you've got. So specifically here, the exact dates of the supervision that was provided to you by each supervisor.
Okay.
Because what we have right now, we can't move forward with that because we don't know how many hours from each supervisor, if they started supervising earlier than their license, would have been of concern.
I have that right now. Do I just submit it to the BA submissions
email? Yeah, so what we're going to do is we're going to send you a formal letter. It is, it's called a FAIR. It will come from board staff. It will detail exactly what is needed in order to move the application back to the committee for a final, for another review. So with that being said, board staff, do you have everything that you need for that FAIR?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay, excellent. And the faster you get it over, whenever that that letter comes over, you know, the faster it comes back. But we do need to ensure that we are able to evaluate the start dates of your supervised experience and if your supervisors were licensed. Okay, that is that one. And I think I have one additional on here. The last applicant that I believe I have is Simone Holland. I see that. Hi, Simone. I see that you are on the call as well. You did make one of your declarations that you had a DUI in the past. It has been relatively recent, so I just wanted to hear from you. I'm glad you are here, kind of what you have learned from this experience, how it has impacted you, and how you feel that you can move forward as a licensed behavior analyst in the state of Arizona serving our populations that we serve here.
Yes. So I received my DUI in December of 2020. Unfortunately, it was grad night from ASU and I made some poor decisions. Thankfully, it resulted in no one getting injured, no damage to property or any accident of that kind. I did do everything that the court required of me, had my license suspended, took the necessary classes and fees. Really learned a lot from that experience. After that, I moved out here to North Carolina and kind of started anew with my husband, where I started and did all my RBT work, all my BCBA field work. I've grown a lot as a person, a professional, now a mother. I think I'm a way different person than I was a few years back, and I'm hoping to move back to Arizona and kind of continue to be this person there.
Okay. Fellow committee members, I can see all of the documentation that that Ms. Holland supplied. She did comply with all of the court requirements. There have been no reoccurring instances or patterns of behavior that would lead me to believe that any members in the state of Arizona would be placed at risk with her as a licensed behavior analyst. So thank you, Ms. Holland, for coming and speaking. And with that, my review of her file, including her education, supervised experience, examination performance, and declarations, finds it to be both administratively and substantively complete. And I would recommend that it moves forward to the full board for potential approval. And Madam Chair, I believe that concludes all of my applications.
Great. Thank you, Ms. Denton. We will move on to applicants 30 through 35. Dr. Stenhoff, if you would lead the charge, sir.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Reviewing, I need to just point one out as a possible clerical issue is Patrick Mills' application on page 7 of the PDF. The supervised experience form that is supplied by the psychology board is just missing the total hours. However, he's got the documentation clearly indicating that he's surpassed that 1,500 hours. So given that, my review of all the files, from files 30 through 35, including the applicant's education, supervised experience, examination, performance, and declarations, I find both these administratively and substantively complete and recommend all applications move forward to the board for approval.
Excellent. Before we move on to the next agenda item, given the time, I would like to give everyone a comfort bake. So if we could come back, is like 5-ish minutes okay? Like 11:15? Go ahead, Dr. Reitz.
Madam Chair, do we want to make a motion regarding these applications before we take a comfort break?
Oh, sorry. Yes, thank you. Yes, I would, please. Does anyone have a motion to move these applications to the board?
I'll go ahead and make the motion to move the applications forward as discussed.
Okay, do I have a second? All right, Dr. Reitz, a second. Any discussion? All right, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right, so moved. Motion passes. Sorry. I'll get it one day, guys. Got the post-it notes ready. All right. So if we could do a quick one and come back at 11:15, does that give everyone enough time? All right. See you all in 5 minutes. All right. I see all my fellow committee members and board staff. So we'll get back to it. Moving on to agenda item 6B, behavior analyst applications for licensure by universal recognition. We have two. Dr. Davey, if you could start with number one, please. And you're still on mute.
That's the most important part of being chair, is to tell us when we are messing up like that. So you're crushing it already, Madam Chair. Let's see. So this application is actually, was a second request for information. Is the applicant here with us? Jennifer McConnell, did I see her? Yeah, there she is. I see her. Ms. McConnell submitted, additional information after, review, of her universal, excuse me, sorry. Her application for universal recognition. And during the review, it was noted that her driver's license had actually been issued and she had become a resident of Arizona back in, I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, back in 2021, I believe is when the license was issued. And so the discussion was us trying to figure out how that actually fit within the universal recognition process, as that is typically reserved for individuals who are moving to the state. And by review of the driver's license, it appears that the application or the applicant had been actually residing in the state since June, at least June 23 of 2021. And so we did do a request for additional information. And Ms. McConnell, if you'd like to just kind of walk us through what your response was, and then we can kind of take it from there.
Yes, I have been a resident of Arizona since 2021, but I live in northern Arizona right on the border of Nevada. I live in Kingman. So I commute to my job an hour and a half in Henderson, and I practice at a clinic in Henderson. So I have a Nevada license currently, but I'm looking to practice in Arizona and would love to not have to commute.
Very good. And we would love to have you in Arizona. That being said, your application cannot go through the universal recognition process because you have been a current resident of the state and are not recently moving here and looking to seek licensure. Ms. Galvin, do you have anything to add to that? Or am I on the right path there?
I do not have anything to add.
Okay, thank you. But we would love to have you, Ms. McConnell, and I would love for you to submit an application to receive your license, just not through that process. And I believe that I can suggest to the board and the board staff that whatever application fee you've already put forward would roll forward to that application. You would not have to pay again, that we would use the fees that you've already submitted to the board for adjudication of this application, that we would use those same fees to adjudicate your full application for licensure in the state.
Okay.
Board staff, can we obviously we don't how, what do we need to do move forward? We don't do we want her to withdraw this and so there's no adverse effects around it? Is that what we would like to have Ms. McConnell do and then have her resubmit her application?
Madam Chair, Dr. Davey, so this not being the first time, we will just sort of navigate the process consistent with how we did it in a with a previous application. In that case, it was an applicant who there was some question about whether Marana, Arizona or Texas was her where she was a resident and the timing. And so the facts are quite similar. So we will just follow the same protocol that we did. You know, by way of reassurance for the applicant, if the committee's direction is, you know, for us to simply honor the application fee that you submitted previously and apply it to the new application, of course, we will do that. And then, you know, the what we do in terms of, you know, with the open application and, you know, processing a new application for you, it's largely an administrative matter. And we'll just communicate with you as we work together through that process.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That concludes my review of that application.
All right, thank you. We'll move on to 6B2, Ms. Denton.
Absolutely. So while I was reviewing Ms. Alicia Stolp's application for licensure via the Universal Recognition Pathway, there were a couple of things that came up. As looking at this, she does have a license that is in good standing in another state, that is North Carolina. Her license was issued on February 9th of 2024. So it requires in the state of Arizona that you have a license in good standing for at least 1 year in another state. Now, we are so stinking close to this that I wanted to see when the full board meeting is occurring. Is it on the 7th?
It is.
So she doesn't meet by the time that comes, that it would be a full year by 2 days. She also was, however, a licensed behavior analyst in the state of Arizona from August 2019 until August of 2023. So she's been a behavior analyst in Arizona in good standing. She moved away. Became licensed in North Carolina, is coming back, applying for universal recognition. I'd like to lean on my fellow committee members here or board staff, yes, to see if we've got some options here.
Ms. Pacman?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question is really for Ms. Galvin. Could the board not adopt a motion that reflects that the license is granted once the 1 year anniversary of the out-of-state license has been achieved, which for all practical purposes is, you know, the following Monday? So can a motion be made with that contingency?
Yeah, and that was going to be my suggestion that if all of the other conditions are met, that they approve the license, but the licensure is not effective until February 10th.
Excellent. That's exactly what I would like to do. That is my motion. My motion is that we move Ms. Stolp's application forward for potential approval to the full board with an effective date of February 10th, 2025, pending there are no new disciplinary actions between now and that period.
Do we need to make two separate motions for each applicant? Because one is to have Ms. McConnell go back and reapply under the traditional route, and then we want to have this. Okay, so I'm getting yeses. So would anyone like to, let's start with number one. So for Jennifer McConnell, do we have a motion for her application.
So moved.
Okay. Anyway, I have a second.
Second.
I'll second.
Is that Dr. Waits? No, it that was Miss Denton.
Or Dr. Sorry. Spinhoff.
Okay. Sorry. Okay. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
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 Aye. Aye. Any opposed? Motion carries. All right. For application two, do we have a motion?
I think I already made a motion.
Okay. That's what I thought. No, we can. Anyone want to second Tish's original or Miss Denton's original motion?
I'll second.
Okay. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? All right. So moved. Okay. That concludes 6B of our agenda. 6C is approval for telehealth registration, and we have none. We are now going on to agenda item number 7. So discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding recent updates from the Behavior Analyst Certification Board. Ms. Pakanon, would you, Ms. Malice had her hand up.
Yes, Madam Chair. I just wanted to give the next code word, which is Jackson. Thank you.
Perfect. Yes, thank you for that, Ms. Malice, and for the reminder. Ms. Pakanon, could you please provide a summary of the matter for the committee for agenda item number 7?
Yes, Madam Chair. The BACB did issue a recent, some more reminders, some updates to the regulator community, in succinctly summarizing those. Affirming that BACB certificates may now only hold one BACB certification at a time, and they are, you know, communicating that out to the stakeholder community, and affirming that the BACB examination will now be derived from what is the new content outline for that examination. And then the reminders are specific to the regulator luncheon that will be held in conjunction with the APBA conference scheduled in March, I believe. And then reiterating the commitment that the BACB will be hosting virtual meetings, virtual sessions for regulators to come together and learn about and discuss regulatory topics. So just for my own curiosity, I'm wondering for the regulators luncheon, if Drs. Davey and Rates have committed to that event, in which case I really can't do this, but I would try to task them with, you know, coming back to this committee with to share any information they learned from that experience.
I will just answer in the affirmative that I have committed to be there at APBA and at that event, and would be happy to volunteer Dr. Rates to report back what we do.
I will be at APBA. I think I need to register for that event, but yes, I would be happy to report back with Dr. Davies' oversight.
Yes, right. Dr. Rates, there's an email that maybe Heidi and I need to forward you that's, that has like the link to confirm that you're going to attend.
That'd be great if you don't mind sending it. Thank you.
Heidi, I'll have to search. I think I deleted it. I don't know if you still have it, but I can go look for it.
I think I can find the registration link and forward it to you, Dr. Rates. So I'll get it to you today.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Pakanon. Does any committee member have a question for Ms. Pakanon? No? Okay. I don't think there's any discussion or question. Do we need a motion for any of this? Nope. Cool. All right, then we will move on to agenda item number 8, discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding proposed legislation, including but not limited to HB 2027, HB 2061, HB 2173, HB 2276, HB 2351, HB 2451, HB 2632, SB 1037, and SB 12:35. Ms. Pakanon, could you please give us an overview?
Yes, I'd be happy to. And just for, you know, clarification purposes, really for the public's benefit, this agenda item expanded a bit very recently. We did post the agenda in a timely fashion in compliance with the Arizona Open Meeting Law, but the agenda item reflects more bills than what you recited, which is always going to be the case. There's always new material to add. And then also, the news that I want to lead with, which is the summary of what is the recommended budget for this agency for fiscal year 2026. That fiscal year begins July 1 of 2025. So we're still 5 months away from, you know, anything being final, decided. There will be debate that will, you know, ensue in the months leading up to July 1. But as this committee is well aware, and if the public has had opportunity to tune in, they have also heard that we requested additional staff support in the form of expanding the capacity of our one member of the staff who is tasked with processing applications for licensure. So expanding the number of hours that that person can invest to process our applications. And then the other big ask was either a half-time FTE or a full FTE to serve as the investigator specific to behavior analyst matters and investigations. The public deserves to know that we have only one person at this time, our deputy director, who is forced to divide her time between the psychologist investigations and the behavior analyst investigations, which is not a sustainable level of staffing. And so here on our second attempt, we requested, you know, more staffing support so we can bifurcate those functions. And what we have received, what we have learned by way of the recommendation, and it's only a recommendation at this point from the governor's office, is that we did get the support for the investigator at the level of a half-time employee, 0.5 FTE. We did not receive any support from that office for the expansion of the licensing specialist hours. I want to come back to that. And then there's another piece in the recommendation, which is to make some staff salary adjustments to bring members of the staff whose compensation is below the midpoint of the salary band in to which they are assigned, to bring them to the midpoint, to bring them to a level of parity. So so mixed news. We're super grateful, of course, about what we did receive, you know, again, in the way of a recommendation. That isn't to say that we have lost all hope where the other big need is concerned, which is the expansion of licensing staff capacity. There is still a possibility, a decent one, I think, for that to come out, for that support to come from the legislature. So what you're looking at in your folder are the relevant information from Governor Hobbs' proposed executive budget. But there's the other important piece, which is the legislature, of course, gets to weigh in. And so, as I said, negotiations are happening, will happen. They will reach a crescendo at some point, as they usually do, and could be May, sometimes it's June. And so when the dust settles, we will eventually see an appropriations bill that I hope includes not only what the governor's office is recommending or what the governor is recommending, but also that other critical piece, which is the staffing expansion for licensing. So why don't I stop there before I move on to the bill summaries that that I want to cover with you today. You may have questions or observations.
Does anyone have a question or observation they'd like to share?
Just hopeful that as we move forward with a bill to have our own regulation as behavior analysts, that the support that staff will receive will be more impressive. And I think that, you know, it's not that I want to appear ungrateful for what has been presented, but when we look at the needs of the state of Arizona in licensing behavior analysts more efficiently and in processing complaints and protecting the public, you know, it's a need to have the right staffing.
Yes, Madam Chair, if I may react to that, for what it is worth, the recommendations that you're looking at today, they are second attempts. So these were submitted for fiscal year 2025 and rejected. So I don't know if there was any sort of, if the recommendation reflects any distinguishment between, you know, we're coming back a second time, which affirms that we weren't bluffing the first time, right? And so, you know, does this need to sort of go through a second request, another cycle before, you know, we achieve the same outcome? Who's to say? I don't know. I know that the governor's office that evaluates our requests, the Office of Strategic Planning and Budget, OSPB, as it's known, they also look very closely at our revenues. So if I submit a request and the money, you know, as projected, won't be there, of course, it doesn't stand a chance. What's, I guess, gratifying is that not only my projections clearly supported everything that we requested, and the revenue projections are exceeding what I projected them to be. So the money is there. So that's not the concern. That's not the issue. So that's why I have some confidence that when the legislature, if they are to consider this, this need, they can see clearly, you know, that, we have the financial foundation, to fulfill all of these critical needs that, that we've talked about now for years. One other just observation, and I don't want to get too far afield of this agenda item, but I do think that what the committee is seeing, and hopefully the public as well, if you look at the last few meeting agendas, I don't need to tell you, they've been, you know, pretty loaded with applications. We are making some headway into that backlog, not nearly as quickly as all of us would prefer, but progress is progress. And so one of the things that I'm going to look at next week with both of the licensing specialists is, you know, where we are in terms of number of open applications and try to figure out to what degree and quantify how our velocity is improving with all of these reforms and new strategies that we have put into place, that we have talked about for months and then, you know, implemented and tested and tried and so forth. So I hope to bring to this committee, you know, some good news in terms of, you know, what, how we've made progress in the absence of having the staffing expansion we still know that we need. Did that all make sense? Okay, good. Well, if there are no other questions, then I can move on to the bill summaries. This is where maybe the committee is at least a little grateful that not all of these bills on the list have a direct bearing on regulation of behavior analysts. So there will be at least one that I will skip over, but The bill that, you know, is going to command most of our attention will be House Bill 2027. And as you know, it passed its first significant hurdle, which is the House Health and Human Services Committee gave it a do pass recommendation. The vote was 10 to 2, which is, that's sort of what I expected. I had hoped for 10 to 1, but 10 to 2 is still, you know, signals strong support. The bill will go to the Rules Committee to determine if it's proper for consideration and conforms to the Constitution, then to the Committee of the Whole, which is the chance for the House to debate the merits of the bill, and then finally the third reading or the third vote. And those steps that I just referred to, that can happen pretty quickly. That can happen in as short as a week's time, or a week and a half, perhaps. So I hope to know very soon and be able to tell you very soon that the bill will proceed to the Senate, where we know that it faces greater opposition and greater concerns. We've heard the lobbyists for the bill articulate as much. That being said, they've worked very hard to bring members of the Senate, you know, to a level of supporting the bill, to at least hearing the bill and dispelling myths about the bill or misconceptions about it. So, you know, I think we all hope that those were very productive discussions and we won't see a repeat of last year this year, and that, you know, the Senate will give the bill the consideration that, that we feel it deserves. Does anyone have any questions about that one? Because it is, you know, the most significant bill we're tracking. Questions or comments? Okay, great.
I think you did a great job explaining it. I don't know. I was able to listen in to the committees or on the hearing. I don't know if other members were able to listen in as well, but I would just encourage everyone on this call to try to get down to the Capitol and create your profile, I forget what it's called, Heidi, you can tell me, but you can go down to the Capitol, sign in at the kiosk and create an account where after you do that the first time, you can log in from anywhere in support or opposition of bills that are running in the state of Arizona. And I would just encourage you that you put that on one of your, you know, field trips in the next couple of weeks to get down there and create that account so that you can continue to sign in and show support for this bill. I think the last time, like I didn't get to see the final numbers, Ms. Pacadon, or maybe Dr. Sanchez, you know, how many people actually signed in favor of it, but it was pretty small. I think when I completed mine, it did not look like there was a lot of people in there. And so I would just encourage those on this call and for the community in general to go ahead and advocate for this bill if you feel that it's appropriate. And by advocating, I mean creating that account and signing in favor. Those of you that are members of AZABA, there was an email that was sent out about how to engage in this. I would encourage you to review that or seek out advice from AZABA. And on cue, Dr. Sanchez, if Madam Chair is up for this, if we could have her speak for a moment, I think that would be beneficial for the community.
Thank you for the opportunity to talk really quick. It was brought up in the meeting how many people are signing on that RTS account in support of the bill. One of their biggest emphasis was the committee and the Board of Psychology being in support of the bill. And so they did really look at those names of those who signed up. If you are an AZABA member, you did receive that email. You do not have to go down to the Capitol. Our lobbyist group will support you in setting up that RTS account. So you just need to send them an email and they will help walk you through the steps. So a lot less work on your end. Just and we definitely
on a public meeting. What's that email address?
For AZABA or for the lobbyists?
How do we get to the lobbyists to say, like, hey, can you set me up an account?
I'll have to pull it up for you.
Okay, that's okay. Sorry, I didn't mean to put you on the spot. I just...
I think put her on the spot. I'm glad that you lobbied me to do that because that will solve maybe some logistical problems.
So that email is Emily, E-M-I-L-Y, at Goodman, G-O-O-D-M-A-N, Schwartz, S-C-H-W-A-R-T-Z.com. And her name is Emily Raymond. And there is a link to create that account on the AZ legislative page. And then she'll help confirm your account for you and provide that support. But we really encourage it, and we really need that continued support. And AZAVA will continue sending out the sign-in to support that bill moving forward.
Thanks, Dr. Sanchez. Ms. Galvin has her hand raised.
Yes, just a reminder, any committee or board members who go on to log their support, ensure that you are doing that advocacy in your individual capacities and not as a member of the committee or the board.
Ms. Pakanon, back to you.
Thank you. I will just briefly touch on the next one, House Bill 2061, titled Administrative Proceedings, Jury Trials. As the comments, as the description states, it would allow individuals when they are a party to a contested case with an agency, administrative agency of the state of Arizona, they can request a trial by jury. I've seen a couple of iterations of this bill. I think there's a lot of questions swirling around it, around this idea in general. So I don't know much about it, but, you know, it's flagged for watching because we can and do have, you know, contested cases that if this were to pass, you know, there would be some impact that we would need to consider and modify accordingly. So the next bill, I think, is important, House Bill 2173. It precludes a licensing authority from including any question on an application for, in our case, a license or the telehealth registry, requesting information about whether the applicant has sought mental health assistance or received a mental health diagnosis or treatment. We can ask if the applicant is currently under another regulatory entity's order in another jurisdiction for monitoring of a health condition, including substance abuse, but the applicant is not required to respond if that monitoring is part of a confidential program. So as you know, we do pose certain declaration questions on applications, initial applications, renewal applications, that really, you know, try to acquire information or insights relative to, you know, is a person experiencing any sort of impairment that would adversely impact their ability to practice with skill and safety. So depending on, you know, what, if this bill passes and what the final language stipulates, we may have to go back and look at those questions and see if those questions conform or if they need to be modified accordingly. So it is sponsored by a member of the Health and Human Services Committee. So I would imagine this will be on an agenda in that committee. It will be heard. I don't recall seeing it on Monday's agenda, but I'll be paying attention to it at any rate. House Bill 2276, this concept is back. It is, I'm losing track, year four, if not year five, of this proposed policy that if an administrative agency adopts a rule that increases regulatory costs by a certain amount in a certain period of time, that we cannot achieve that through the, as we have historically done, through a rulemaking process. It requires now the legislative ratification of that as a required. So what's interesting about this is that This has been vetoed previously in a previous year by Governor Hobbs. It also became one of the ballot initiatives, maybe you remember from your three-page ballot if you're in Maricopa County, that I think it was 315 that was defeated by the voters. So nonetheless, the concept is still coming back, even though the voters, you know, said no. So this, and there's at least one other semi-clone of this bill. So I'm paying attention to those as well. You know, it's the governor's office is aware that that this bill has been dropped, and this concept is still, you know, still has some support. What, for our purposes, the devil's in the details in terms of the actual number. I think that right here, right now, if we were to initiate a rulemaking to raise application fees for behavior analysts, we would not test this ceiling. We would not come close to it. If at some point in the future, I can't say if and when that could be, but if renewal fees were to increase, that is a possibility that financial threshold would be exceeded. So that's just a lot of, you know, speculation and uncertainty. And I don't see that is something that is in any way imminent that would impact the Board of Psychologist Examiners, a future board of behavior analysts. So I provide you with some reassurance that, you know, the math doesn't math in our case, but that doesn't mean that would always be the case. I hope that made sense. Moving on to House Bill 2351, this bill would remove that five-year restriction for adverse actions, for disciplinary action to appear on boards' websites. This bill was introduced last year, didn't even get a committee hearing. I don't know if it will this year, but the sponsor is still same sponsor. She's still committed to this idea. She held a stakeholder meeting, and the consensus of the executive directors really was, you know, 5 years is too short. In most cases, the executive directors had direction from their board, as I did, which is 5 years is too short. A longer period of time makes more sense, as far as, you know, in the spirit of transparency and for the benefit of the public, you know, whether that longer period of time is 25 years or perpetuity, you know, that can certainly be debated. From an administrative perspective, leaving an action active for in perpetuity is the lowest level of effort for us. As it stands right now, when there is a time limit, whether it's 5 years or 17 and a half or 18 and three quarters, we have to track that. And so we have to know and be aware of, there are specific days on the calendar where an action needs to be pulled down. It's still part of the public record. It can still be obtained by the public upon request, but that posting goes away. So this is really in the spirit of, you know, giving the public access to information for a longer period of time. I will skip over House Bill 2441 since it only impacts psychologists. In the case of House Bill 2451, administrative hearings, change of judge, again, we're talking about contested cases. It does prescribe an opportunity for any party to a contested case, could be the respondent, could be the state agency, as I read it, to request a reassignment of an administrative law judge if certain conditions, you know, can be demonstrated, and those are prescribed in the comments. I won't spend a lot of time talking about that because we have so few contested cases that would, first of all, that go before an administrative law judge. And, you know, this seems to me to be an edge case, maybe as far as we're concerned. Maybe it isn't an edge case elsewhere, but I'll still track this bill. and keep you informed about it. So House Bill 2632, that's another iteration of what I described earlier about, you know, the legislative ratification of any rulemaking that imposes additional costs at a prescribed level. House Bill 2707, that one posted just a couple of days ago, that it's an act of unprofessional conduct for a health professional to deny health care or to provide health care that is less than the standard of care to a person based on the person's vaccination status. I would argue it's already unprofessional conduct, but maybe the sponsors feel the need to have this clearly articulated in the statutes and memorialized. Maybe members, you have thoughts. Maybe your thoughts are different than mine. I would welcome any observations or comments you might have about that bill.
Does anyone have any comments or discussion? Ms. Denton?
The only thing that I could think of is, you know, if there were, for example, like ABA clinics that were in Arizona that were refusing to admit members who had a different vaccination status, such as being unvaccinated. But I know in Arizona, you know, it's, I don't know that it necessarily applies to ABA clinics at this time, but for example, like in education, you can't deny a kiddo to go into a public school if they have the appropriate documentation in place for why they don't have vaccines and that type of thing. So it's interesting to see. That's just the comment I have. I'm paying attention. I'm listening. You have done fabulous, Heidi. I'm reading everything as you go. And I just wanted to give you a little bit of engagement so you could break up how much you had to say.
Wow, I appreciate that. So obviously that one needs to stay on our radar. The next one, forgive me, I don't remember if I talked to the committee about Senate Bill 1037, which is the Health Board's Fund Balances Fee Bill. I know that I inflicted this description on the members of the board most recently, but did I do a summary for this committee of the bill? Okay. What this bill purports to do is the intent behind it, or at least one part of the intent, is to ensure that agencies' funds, their bank balance, if you will, do not grow to the degree that they are tempting for fund sweeps, the way that we experienced fund sweeps on June 30th of 2024. And so it's sort of a suppression mechanism, and it gives the boards the latitude to adjust fees in order to manage that fund balance, with the ceiling being 2 years of operating expenses plus 5% on top of that. So for what it is worth, at the time that the fund sweeps occurred, our fund was pretty much at that level, 2 years of operating plus 5%. I think that's pure coincidence, but anyway, I just share that fact that, you know, we had that status once upon a time. As I've said, it's going to take us some time to replenish the fund to even reach this level. And now that we are hopeful we will get to spend, we finally have the spending permission that we need, you know, to address our needs, the growth of that fund will be slower than it might otherwise. So I manage, I monitor, I would say, the fund balance very closely, and I'm continually estimating, you know, how much operating do we have, how much are we over collecting, you know, those kinds of things. But there's still some questions around how does this get around the requirement that, you know, we are directed to collect fees of a prescribed amount in rule. This statute must supersede that, so that, you know, there could be a point in the future where we do the math and we reduce fees from $500 every 2 years to $250 every 2 years. So that is, that's plausible. That is a scenario that could happen. It's really just predicated on, you know, how much revenue are we collecting and how fast. We don't control that factor at all, right? We just, applicants come to us and we collect their fees. Licensees renew and grow. And so, you know, compounding almost, our fund grows and we simply don't have any way of restraining it. This bill is an effort to try to restrain it and bring some relief to the fee paying licensees, which I think, you know, we would all agree is positive. Personally, I don't see that it's suppressive to have 2 years plus 5% of operating money in our fund. To me, that is a comfortable level, especially as soon as you adjust fees to reach that ceiling, the very next day we've exceeded the ceiling because three people have applied for licensure, right? So I don't have a lot of consternation about this bill. It's going to affect different boards in different ways. And maybe now is the time to say that if the behavior analyst board is established, they get to take their money, their own piggy bank with them. So there isn't going to be sort of this, start from zero and build your own fund up. And the rate at which the behavior analyst fund is growing is, as a percentage of our licensees, it's growing much faster than the psychology fund. So a good problem to have. Sorry, that was a lot. Questions about that one? Okay. So I'll skip Senate Bill 1125. That's specific to psychology. Senate Bill 1235. This could have implications for a future Board of Behavior Analysts because it adjusts the ratio such that public members exceed the number of professional members on boards. I will tell you that this is a concept that I'm aware of. It was first floated in 1995. None of us were here. I was in grad school, not even in Arizona. But this, my point being that this idea gets revived periodically and it dates back. That wasn't that long ago, I want to believe, but yet it was. So this has never gained, you know, traction to the degree that this kind of legislation becomes enacted. There are, I think we can recognize why the policy reasons that might be behind this. Obviously, boards are going to be, you know, really concerned about the public members forming the quorum constituting either all public members, which is maybe an edge case, but quite plausible still, or a majority of members of a quorum, which means that the professional members, the subject matter experts, are not it suppresses their ability to provide, you know, their expertise, their opinions, their assessments about standard of care and so forth. So in other cases with other boards, they have diverse professionals among them. And so they want, you know, every type of pharmacy practitioner or every type of, as many sub-disciplines or specialty areas in whatever to be represented on their board. That's kind of a concern here where the psychology board is as well, maybe less so for a board of behavior analysts. But also at the end of the day, public members are very, very hard to recruit, retain, and sometimes they're it's a challenge to engage them, to attend meetings and be fully participating. So this could really be you know, crippling to some boards. So those are the kinds of discussions and concerns that are being discussed around this. Anything else on that?
Not on that one, but I'm chewing on the vaccination one. And so I think before I make my comment, I'm going to ask you a question of, do we believe this one has traction to at least get out of, I believe it was, is it a House one or a Senate one?
House Bill 2707.
And the reason I'm asking is, understand that the vaccination status is very personal. However, ADHS has very clear guidelines and appropriate guidelines around immunizations required for entry into K-12 schools. And I would think that we would have many behavior analysts in the state, as well as psychologists, as well as other quote unquote healthcare professionals, that would have a hard time putting the rest of their population that they serve at risk. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's worth paying attention to, because it's going to come in conflict with several of our current statutes and rules in terms of how we uphold ourselves as professionals and how we interact with our those that we serve. And it's definitely going to come into conflict with the BCBA's code of ethics. Mm-hmm. And to a lesser extent, it's going to come in conflict with ADHS's recommendations. And for programs that serve center-based programs that may have 35 kids in a facility similar to like a, you know, what a school would have, there is real risk around a lack of vaccinations. So mm-hmm. I do think we need to pay attention to that, just so we can keep our group of healthcare professionals informed as to where that's going.
Thank you, Dr. Davey. My insights are really limited. What I will tell you is that, again, it dropped so very recently, I think 2 days ago. It has yet to be first read and second read, which second reading would assign it to a committee. And depending on the committee, sometimes that clues us into whether a bill might, you know, see some forward momentum. So I would be looking for, you know, those clues next week. I think the things that you are articulating, I would expect other health professionals, there are many, to come forward and, you know, have and offer their perspectives as well. So this could be one of those bills where the RTS system reflects a whole lot of opinion, and really it just breaks it down in terms of, do you support, are you opposed or are you neutral? So it's always interesting to look at certain bills to see, you know, who is weighing in support or against a bill, how lopsided is that support or opposition. So those kinds of things, that's data that will emerge in the next several days and weeks, probably.
Thank you.
You are welcome. So going back to just two more bills quickly, House Bill 1243, Open Meetings Call to the Public. This would compel the any agency that, or public body, excuse me, that makes available a call to the public. It stipulates that it must be done at the beginning of the meeting, and that if an open call to the public exceeds 30 minutes, the public body may choose to continue the remainder at a later time during the meeting. So I am not sure what the intent is behind that bill, but for what it's worth, the Board of Psychologist Examiners holds their call to the public at the beginning. So, and then finally, there is a slight tweak that we may have to make if Senate Bill 1372 passes. This is mostly, we're tracking this mostly for administrative purposes. It's really to ensure that anyone who's requesting public records from a public body, certainly including this board, that they are not using those records for financial gain, for a commercial use. So that's been in place for a long time. It's just trying to put more teeth into that language. So that is the list today. I do have one more, at least one more impactful bill that I'm still waiting to kind of craft the summary for it. You're going to hear about it very soon. It's a Senate bill. And what it does is it prescribes new requirements for how this board would conduct investigations. There's a lot going on to it. So I need to spend more time with it before I'm prepared to really give the board and later the committee a decent summary of it. So that's what I have for you today. I'm happy to take any more questions or comments.
Thank you, Ms. Pekinon, for all of that. Questions or comments, discussion from any of the other committee members? Just heart emojis from Tisha. All right.
For what it is worth, I guess this is significant. Members of the Senate have until, I think, 5 p.m. on Monday to submit bill requests. And the House deadline is 1 week later on February 10th. So what that means is at least another full week of, reviewing and pulling and analyzing new bills. I don't know that it looks like there could be another record number. Last year was a record number of bills. It could be exceeded this year, but it's hard to say with that much time left. So a lot going on.
Am I correct to say we don't need to do any kind of motion for this agenda item?
Correct. I would prompt the committee for one if I felt like a recommendation from this committee, to the board would be helpful for the board to consider whether to take a position on any of these bills. And that isn't necessarily, I don't see the need for that today. That could be a scenario in the future. Of course, we know House Bill 2027, that is supported by the board. A formal motion supports that. So I may ask you in the future for a recommendation
and
to support, I suppose.
Yeah, and with that support, going back to the conversation we had from the hearing the other day with the licensing board, how do we get that support in front of those committee members? Do we share that? Do we share the minutes from this meeting with Mr. Goodman and I'm going to forget Brandy's last name, so that they have that information that the board, because I believe, I forget who asked, but there was a point blank question: is the Board of Psychology on board with this? And Stuart articulated the answer as a no, but he, it would be nice if he had something to say. Absolutely, they're on board with this. Here are the minutes from their psychology board meeting where they have accepted this and wanted to move it forward.
Yes, Dr. Davey. So actually, here's what was really happening. I was supposed to be at that hearing, but I was sick. So I had had several text message exchanges with Stuart that day, and at least one phone call. So Stuart was checking in, to confirm that the board did support. I did hear him say, although it was a little hard to discern, I did hear him say that the board supported this bill. It was not as clearly stated as maybe as it could have been, but I didn't feel like he misrepresented anything, in terms of the board's formal, support. I had registered as a representative of the board, the board support in the RTS system. I had initially registered that I would be available to answer questions, but then when I became sick, I followed up instead with an email to Representative Bliss to tell her, I'm sorry, I won't be there. I will be listening for any, questions that the members might have that are appropriate for me. But really, Stuart and I were able to achieve the same thing via text message. So I think the record establishes, clearly enough that the board the board wants this. The board of psychologist examiners, you know, wants to offload these behavior analysts as soon as possible. I'm kidding. I know there to have been conversations between the lobbying team and Representative Bliss to assure her that, you know, everyone sees this the same way. The major stakeholders see this the same way.
Very good. Thank you.
All right. If nothing else on item 8, then we'll move on to number 9, discussion, consideration, and possible action concerning unlicensed board certified behavior analysts employed in Arizona schools. So Ms. Pakanon, would you please provide an update on this matter for the committee?
Yes, Madam Chair. This is coming back to the committee for just one important but non-controversial, I believe, assignment, if you will. So the board, as the committee, consistent with the committee's position, the board wants the communication to go forward to all Arizona BCBAs as it is written. And this is, of course, the communication that advises of the non-existent licensure exemption, the mirage that was sort of created by that statutory language. And what the board's recommended resolution is, which is to provide any impacted BCBAs with a reasonable amount of time to apply for licensure or acquire an alternative certification that the Department of Education issues. So why this is coming back to the committee is solely for the reason that they felt, the members felt that identifying a specific due date for those applications was a preferable strategy over advising in the email, you have 120 days to file an application. That could create some ambiguity in terms of, well, you know, is that calendar days or, you know, inclusive of today when I got the email, or, you know, what precisely is that application due date? And so the board did not prescribe a due date. They said, kick it to the committee and let the committee decide what that due date should be. And this is where I believe Dr. Stenhoff probably has an opinion that we would all want to hear about, you know, what sort of date in the future is reasonable, assuming that we can get the communication to go out in the next 10, 14 days, which I think is entirely likely. But what date makes sense for both the board's purposes, public protection purposes, if you will, and, you know, anyone impacted who would needs to make a decision about applying for licensure.
Madam Chair, Ms. Pakenham, would you give me the approximate date that you're thinking the email or the letter would go out?
So if we can convince the BACB, if their process reflects what our earlier experience was, if we could convince them, you know, that we want to move on this quickly, I think that they could turn this around within a week to 10 days. I would be, of course, you know, make this a big priority to transmit this to the BACB and ask for, you know, that consideration that it be sent out as promptly as possible. We were sort of semi-targeting June 1, I believe it was, as, yeah, you know, that a date that seemed to make sense. So if the communication goes out by February 15th, allowing applicants until June 1, is that something that the committee finds comfortable, reasonable, acceptable?
Madam Chair, Ms. Pakenham, I would say so. I know you're saying June 1. I was looking at June 2, but June 1 is just great. It's it falls on a Sunday, so that was the only reason I was pushing.
Our portal is open.
And I think June 1 is a beautiful day. I like it. So,
yeah, I think it's one that you know, is sort of just by virtue of what it is, it's memorable. So it would be hard to, I think a little more difficult for someone to say, I forgot what the deadline is, or, you know, I just missed this deadline. And honestly, we do see a lot of application activity over the weekend. It stands to reason that, you know, applicants can set aside the time during a weekend, you know, to really, they may work on their application over a series of days, which saves their work. But, you know, if they need some, you know, to allocate a certain amount of focus time, I should look at this. Do we receive more applications on Saturdays and Sundays than we do the rest of the week? I'd like to see what that looks like.
Any other discussion around June 1st being the date, comments or considerations? Do we have a motion?
Can I just ask a functional question on a June 1st date, given we've got Memorial, is Memorial Day bumping up around there as well?
Oh, I do not know the answer to that.
Maybe the weekend before. Let me see if I can find it.
Look, Madam Chair, Dr. Davey, Memorial Day weekend, well, Memorial Day falls on the 26th, so it'd be the Monday prior to that Sunday, yeah.
Yeah, my only concern around that is just like schools getting out, school districts email, like people are kind of like winding down the school year as we get close to Memorial Day. So I just wanted to make sure we weren't going to, I don't think there's a good time. There's never going to be a good time. I just wanted to make sure we are aware of the fact that people may not check their emails, particularly in public school systems after, if they're not in year round, after the ending of the spring semester, whatever it's called, yeah, spring semester. But I don't think there's anything.
I think that, but I think the email is going to go out. It's just the due date would be June 1st. So the email would already be distributed within the next month.
Okay. So then I think June 1 is appropriate because that will get us through kind of like the end of their contract year. So that sounds good.
Okay. Ms. Denton, did you have a comment?
No, I was going to make one and then I decided not to.
Do we have a motion for June 1st?
So moved.
Do we have a second?
I will second.
All right. It has been first motion made by Dr. Senhoff, seconded by Ms. Denton. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? All right. Motion carries. All right, we will move on to agenda item number 10. Oh, sorry, I do see someone in the audience with their hand raised. That's on purpose.
Yes, hi, sorry. I've been waiting for a little while. I just had a question about the LBA thing. I'm one of the applicants. I just wanted to double check, what are next steps that we have to do? You guys said you'd be pushing it to the board for approval.
We've passed this agenda item a bit ago. Ms. Denton, was he one of yours? I'm trying to think who reviewed your.
I think that was mine.
Okay. Ms. Rates, I'll leave it up to you whether or not you want to readdress it right now of what the final. I don't remember what the final vote was for this particular application.
Perhaps we reach out to staff on Monday. And staff could update him with the outcome.
Okay. Thanks, Ms. Galvin. Okay, so we're going to ask you to reach out to board staff and they will get back to you.
Okay, thank you.
Yep. All right. So item number 10 is discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding draft proposed substantive policy statement clarifying ARS 32-2091.08 specific to exemptions to licensure. Ms. Pakanon, if you would be so kind as to continue to walk us through all of these updates for the committee.
Yes, Madam Chair. Actually, I'm a little concerned because I'm looking at something. Oh my goodness. Okay. I think that somehow I commingled documentation in your uploaded file. I do apologize. If you open the one that is titled as it should be, Memo Draft SPS ARS 32-2091.08, and scroll past the pages 1 and 2 that I mistakenly merged into your PDF. What begins on page 3 represents, I think it's our best effort to, and by we, I mean Dr. Davey, the committee tasked Dr. Davey, Dr. Davis Wilson, a former member and guest speaker, and me to pull together a draft substantive policy statement to try to address a whole lot of questions around these licensure exemptions that have been very have been deeply analyzed and discussed and debated, you know, by this committee. So the licensure exemptions are found in ARS 32-2091.08. So it was, I gratefully took on this challenge. So to take, you know, really great content from both of these individuals and then force this content into this format that we are required to follow for a substantive policy statement, or SPS, as I want to call it going forward for obvious reasons. I hope we did the topic justice by pulling this all together. I am not the subject matter expert by any means. I've already named who they are. So, you know, I think a lot of your questions or your discussion or your debate will be targeted more at them to me. I'm happy to sort of talk about, you know, assuming this is, we at whatever point the committee reaches a point where you want to make a recommendation to the board to approve an SPS, I can talk about, you know, what I need to do, when does this happen, you know, how does it become formal and adopted and a thing that we put on our website and, you know, broadcast to the world and so forth. But I think I really want to stand back now and let the LBAs in this space have that discussion together.
I wonder if before we start the discussion, I know we're close to 12:30. I don't know if it's too early for a code word, Ms. Malice.
Yes, Madam Chair, I can do another code word. The next code word is classic. Classic. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Malice. If other committee members have questions, I'll let them go first. I have a few questions of my own. See everyone else very attentively, perhaps reading. So while you guys do that, I do have a question. So I'm on page 4. I think it's page 4, according to my PDF reader. And I'm on the second paragraph, and I just wanted some kind of clarity the way that the sentence is structured. So additionally, pursuant to ARS 32-2091, parentheticals 12, parenthetical H, supervisors must develop and document a supervision plan for each client to whom services are provided by the matriculated graduate student or trainee. So I wanted to get some clarity from Dr. Davis Wilson, Dr. Davey. I'm assuming in this instance, we're referring to the client as the one who's receiving behavior analytic services by an agency. Am I correct, at least so far? Yes, thumbs up. Okay. So when we're talking about the supervisor developing a plan for each, I guess I wanted to, usually when we have applicants come on and they're practicing in behavior analytic capacity, we say, is there a supervision contract in place? And usually I think when we're discussing that, we are saying, is there someone who's licensed in the state of Arizona that is supervising you in your work, you're meeting on a frequent basis, to make sure that what you're doing is in alignment with standards of care. And should something happen to you, that supervisor would essentially be responsible for that client. So when I read this, I usually, I guess, think of that contract as kind of a general between behavior, licensed behavior analyst and person who wants to be a licensed behavior analyst. When I read this sentence, it makes it seem like if there would be multiple supervision contracts that are related to each individual client. Like there'd be multiple contracts. If I'm a trainee and Dr. Davis Wilson was my supervisor at the time and I'm I'm doing behavior analytic services for three or four kids, then there would be three or four individual contracts unique to each client. So that's why I'm reading it. And I just wanted some clarity if that's what was the intention, if I'm just an idiot, which is also possible. I just wanted to get some clarity about what's the takeaway for that area. Ms. Denton's laughing because you know it's true.
No, you're not an idiot. And I had the same question. So if you're an idiot, I'm an idiot. And I don't want to be an idiot.
Madam Chair, if I may, I'm happy to take the first stab at this one. So the issue, so I think that part of the way that perhaps it's being interpreted is that there would be individual contracts. And I don't think that that is the intention. So I'm going to crosswalk through just a few other standards real quick to kind of understand where that one comes from. So in the CASP manual, so the Council for Autism Service Providers, there is a really nice kind of summary of what three-tiered billing can look like. And they do a really nice job in identifying that at the end of the day, the BCBA is still responsible for the child or the client, I should say. The problem there, and that's just an example of a nice way that it's put. When you go to AMPM 320, what AMPM 320S, which is the ABA policy, states is that there will be an identified supervision plan when using a trainee. So essentially what this is saying is the contracts, it doesn't have to be individual contracts, but that in order for a behavior analyst to be truly exercising control, there needs to be some understanding of their role on that case. What we are continuing to see here, I talked to health plan as of last week, is this, oh yeah, I think they might be billing under the clinical director. And then you ask the clinical director and it's, oh, that's not my case. Well, who is responsible for the delivery of services? And so what we're attempting to do here is to say there are three practice levels in statute. One is the LBA, who has the only authority to practice. Then there's the exemption of they can use arm one, which is the trainee or the student, or they can use arm two, which is the technician or some combination of, given delegation, scope of practice, all of those things. But what happens is we shorthand it and we're seeing it shorthanded and read as, okay, well, this is saying a technician can practice so long as we meet the RBT supervision requirements. Then we take that to the student and the trainee. Well, they can take a caseload so long as we're meeting with them twice a month. You're getting our two contacts, you know, each month four contacts, each month two with the child. But what it's not capturing is if I'm a center-based behavior analyst and I've got hybrid cases, or I'm sending my students out to the homes, does that family know who the behavior analyst is? Does the technician know? Because sometimes in audits and such, the technician's like, oh, I thought, and they list the trainee as the behavior analyst. And then in looking at the records in deep dive, what we're finding is they're supervising to the minimum of the national standard for that part of the deal. But what they're missing is the unprofessional conduct piece that says, if you are going to delegate and assign tasks, you must exercise control. So what we're trying to say here is very consistent with the Access AMPM. And I would argue, because the CAS model says a BCBA should still have 25% of kind of some level of supervision in there. And so whether that is that they're supervising the trainee and doing case conceptualization, observing the trainee doing parent training, whether it's that piece or it's different, that's fine. But I think the biggest outstanding issue that we're trying to address in that statement is this continued disconnect between the licensee and the outcomes of the client receiving services. And so I think we were trying to be careful to not overly define what that supervision plan can be. I think that it could fall in a treatment plan pretty nicely. I think that it could fall within organizations' policies with then kind of a tiered level of review. So for most of our clients, this level of supervision and this model is going to be great. But if X, you know, conditions are in place, we might do, you know, a different individualized plan. And I think that that would allow for the flexibility without having to do, add the extra work or do all those things, but allow for the flexibility so that you as a committee, instead of just the blanket, are you supervised or not, which is clearly defined by different people as different things, that you would be able then to look at the purpose of the supervision, which in the case of the trainee is to still, you know, address the outcomes of the client. And I think that's my stab at it.
Yeah, for the record, like, I don't disagree or hate any of that. I just wanted to make sure, like, as I'm reading it, we all have the same kind of interpretation of, like, what that includes. And Dr. Davey, I know you're unmuted, and I'll let you chat in a second. You know, CASB used to also have, you know, kind of set up tiers of, if you are a BCBA, you know, here's the type of caseload you can handle. If you're a BCBA plus a BCABA, you know, here's how you could potentially expand your caseload. I know they've changed that. And also BCABA is not equivalent to a trainee. I'm just curious if you guys gave any thought to adding in like limitations for how many is too many? Because I also don't want to get into the pickle where we have a licensed behavior analyst that is technically, there's a contract to support it of 30 kids. That's just not maintainable, I don't think. So I just was curious. The center director. Well, how many trainees does the center director have? How many clients does each trainee have? I can see that expand to a pretty high number quite quickly. And so I just wanted to, I guess, ask that question as well. But Dr. Davey, if you had thoughts about my first question before we talk about my second question, that's fine too.
A couple of things, right? I think, so we went back and forth on this document multiple times and redlined it and greenlined it and purplelined it. But as I'm reading this section around, this section that we are discussing right now is around the matriculated graduate student or the trainee. And it goes into, it references at the top of that page that, you know, all service provisions by the grad student or the trainee shall be directed by the documented supervision plan. And that plan is defined actually in Arizona Administrative Code R426.404.2C6. And that goes on to really outline what the expectation is around said supervision of someone who is in that area. So,
right. But the last paragraph, you know, kind of has a very similar language, and it says they must develop a supervision plan for each client to services provided by a person who is not a matriculated graduate student or trainee. So I don't know if I then link the fourth paragraph up to, or again, maybe that's five now. One, two, three. Yeah. So I don't know then, do you link that back up to, and we're assuming that's also in alignment with what the BACB has? Because again, they're not, if I just passed my test yesterday and I've submitted my application today, I'm not going to be licensed or come before this committee for a few months, probably, because poor Ms. Malice has applications coming out of her ears. I think that puts me into the last box there. So again, are we still reading back that we would assume that my supervision contract still mirrors that of when I was a trainee, because it's separate, like it's a separate paragraph. Like you've identified them as being two different bodies the way I read it. You're either a matriculated graduate student / trainee or you're not. So again, are we holding them to the same standard as a trainee, even though we're listing them as different folks?
My answer to that is yes. We want to hold them to the similar standard.
Okay.
But I think that the part that I'm still trying to remember, and I can't look at all the edits, is that whether or not we called it a supervision plan for each client, because I think what I heard Dr. Wilson describe was that, you know, there's development and documentation for how each client is served. And she mentioned it could be fit nicely into the treatment plan. Mm-hmm. I don't know that I thought through, and maybe I'm forgetting that we had this discussion, which could have happened, that it was going to be, you know, each client had an individual document. So if I am a trainee serving, you know, six kids and under the supervision of a BCBA, then instead of having my supervision document that talks about all the things I'm doing and may include individual information about the clients I'm serving, I don't know that the intent was to have six documents, one for each kiddo. And so we could clean that language up, and that could just be an artifact of us red lighting and green lighting and blue lighting things throughout. It could be just develop the supervision plan, you know, as part of the treatment plan, or however we decide to clean that up so that it's very clear that we're not expecting an individual, like to your point, an individual contract for every single client. That I think would be unreasonable, not only for our grad students, I'll speak for Dr. Stenhoff's students. I think that would be prohibitive then also to the BCBAs that are overseeing them and the LBAs, and would just be a logistical nightmare for them. So I think we probably do want to go back and make that a little bit more explicit and link it back up to, I won't read off the whole thing again, but to the where the plan's defined already in our administrative code. And I also just want to caution to the committee, I'm going to channel my inner Ms. Galvin, and that is while the CAS guidelines are guidelines, and I will disclose that I'm a subject matter expert, helped develop those from their initial inception, they are not Arizona statutes and rules and regulations. They are not adopted by the state of Arizona. And so while I agree that the spirit of them should be included here, our task is to tie the substantive policy back to existing administrative code and statute.
Duly noted. Ms. Pakenon had her hand up first, and then we'll go to Dr. Davis Wilson.
Thank you. What I'm going to recommend is that if there are going to be any edits to this document, I should have said this from the onset, as challenging as it is sometimes to corral both of these experts to get them in the same place at the same time, I'm not naming names in terms of, you know, who's more challenging, but I think that it was probably a better use of everyone's time if we, the group, is tasked with meeting again to make any refinements that the committee wants rather than trying to accomplish them today. But I'll defer to the committee. That's just my recommendation that we do it that way.
Thanks, Ms. Pakenon. Dr. Davis-Wilson.
Yeah, I would like, and I agree, and I do agree on a lot of it. I think this is still a point of clarification, though, that I think that the committee input matters because, again, and if it's the verbiage piece, that's one piece, but you essentially still have two components, and one is the supervision towards the national standards, and two is the care for the client. And they can be two different things. And we see it time and time again, where again, a supervisor is supervising in the clinic, but not in the home because it doesn't fit with their schedule. But because they're meeting the standards in the clinic, the standards are being met, but they're not being met from a standard of practice piece. And I think, so again, I don't think it needs to be an entirely different document, but there should be some process for documenting, even for transparency to the client themselves of here's our tiered service model. Here's what each role does. And again, if you're in, let's say, an early intervention setting, that's going to look pretty similar across most of your clients. And so to incorporate that into your informed consent process, your intake process, all of that to document that it is clear and transparent to all parties that the responsible person over the care is the LBA, I think that's what that's speaking to there. It's not necessarily a contract or needing to be
super, super individualized, unless it would be warranted. So if you've got a practice that, again, has that hybrid clinic in home, if you have some telehealth services, how are we making sure that the individual types of services still have that direct connection to that licensed behavior analyst? And so I do think that they are different, but the idea of conceptualizing and if the committee is in agreement, I agree that Dr. Davey and I can go back and wordsmith it, but the idea of that wasn't most definitely to make things harder and to create more checking of the boxes. It's to again really figure out a way to conceptualize how do we address this ongoing issue of families not knowing who their BCBA is, trainees not knowing who to put on their trackers. You know, these are significant issues we continue to see. And I know that I see that Dr. Woods has her hand raised. I'm going to ask the committee to, you know, consider hearing from Dr. Woods. Dr. Woods has extensive knowledge in the AMPM policy. She also has extensive knowledge in some of the themes that we're seeing and how people are utilizing the services. So it may be of interest from the committee to hear from Dr. Woods.
I've been told I'm the boss today. So yes, I'd like to hear from Dr. Woods. Go ahead.
Well, thank you for allowing me to address the committee. It was actually going to be for a question, but I think it ties in fairly well to what Diana was saying about, you know, the needs for a clarification on exactly what that supervision schedule looks like and what the agreements are. The family has a requirement to receive services with informed consent. And that's by, you know, BACB standards, as well as by our state requirement for services provided under Medicaid. And are they really receiving services with informed consent if they don't have knowledge of what that supervision tier really looks like, what that structure entails? And if they are, how are they able to judge whether or not they're receiving quality, adequate services? So I would recommend that we would try to address defining that in a little bit more specificity. I haven't read the draft, so I don't know exactly what's been written there, but I do think that that is something that, you know, Access has an appetite to see, as well as what I was going to question was if there had been any further definition into the terminology of trainee, because in the statute, it says matriculated graduate student or trainee, and there's not additional explanation as to who is a trainee, what are they allowed to do under the supervision of a licensed behavior analyst? And that is a question that we have been receiving already in some public comment leading up to the posting of our updated AMPM 320S policy. But we are also looking a lot into some of the billing practices, and we're not able to currently delve into some of those supervision practices and understand what that really looks like. You know, how many trainees should a behavior analyst be overseeing? Should one behavior analyst be overseeing 45 trainees? Is that really best practice? So I will stop talking because I have a timer. Thank you.
Hey, Dr. Woods. Dr. Davis-Wilson, I saw your hand first. Go ahead and then we'll move on to Dr. Davey.
Yeah, I think these are all very pertinent questions. I do think that the policy statement is limited to providing clarification to what's already in statute and rule. So we can't add. Every bit of it has to crosswalk to something else. We can't add additional information And I would argue it's not traditionally housed there. That's where the health plans and other policies would then kind of prescribe out what those general, you know, standards of practice are. And so this policy, you know, in the interim of being able to clean up the language, would be essentially to take what we already have in statute and kind of try to regurgitate it in a way that would promote higher safety for the consumers. And to Dr. Wood's point, I think like even in the informed consent and there's other ways to address it where it doesn't have to be a separate like, I know it's worded plan. As far as the question around the definition of trainee, in this, we are allowing the trainee to be anybody who would be essentially enrolled in a supervision program, meaning that they would have a supervision plan, aka the contract. It's just called a plan in our rules. They would be meeting all of the national standards of the board. So the contact hours, all of those things would still constitute being enrolled in a program and therefore still constitute being a trainee. We are just providing that clarification that the extended authority would mean that licensee needs to clearly document that they are responsible for the outcomes of that member. And we provide just some bullet points of what would make that clear. As far as how many cases they can cover or not, or any of those things, that I don't think can be defined here, because there's nothing in the statute that would give us that ability. But there is in the statute, again, that exercised control. And I get that behavior analysts by habit, we tend to need that defined for us. But the reality of it is that's not how it, you know, that's not how it works. That's not how it's defined in other statutes or in other fields or in other professions. And so it's really going to take behavior analysts learning how to develop systems to assess and evaluate whether or not they truly are competent to have a caseload, and judge that by the skill set of the trainees that they're producing, because we've got that piece of it, and then the outcomes of the clients. And so I still think that that falls outside of necessarily the regulatory board's ability to provide guidance to. I think the regulatory board's piece is, was the public protected in the system that you built as a behavior analyst? And if it was not, that's going to be problematic. So this is just kind of trying to connect those dots.
Thank you, Dr. Davis-Wilson. Dr. Davey?
A couple of comments back for Dr. Wood's comments. Agree with what Dr. Davis-Wilson just said with regard to us being able to define things. The reality is that the best definitions we currently have around what supervision, what supervisee means, they're already in the definition section, as are the outlines of what a supervision plan looks like and who, what the steps are. It essentially gives, kind of fumble trying to find the right document, but it's in our rules section under R4-26-404.2, supervised experience requirements. And that goes on for quite some period of time, essentially outlining what the BACB's requirements were at the time. And this was adopted through that. And it does go through a list of like what the nature of supervision is. Effective supervision includes developing performance expectations for the supervisee, observing the supervisee and providing performance feedback, modeling technical, professional, ethical behavior. It goes all the way through a list of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 different items that are put there, and how effective supervision can be conducted. So that already exists, and I think we can rely on that as good law that we can point back to for not only our matriculated grad student and our trainee, but someone who is working under the exemption of extended authority working underneath the BCBA for our tiered delivery model system, or while we have a BCBA, a current nationally certified BCBA who is waiting for their license application to be adjudicated. I think it provides the ability for us to say, here's what supervision needs to look like, regardless of what, you know, what status you're in. If you're working under extended authority, if you're a grad student, you need to conform to current Arizona administrative code. My other comment back to Dr. Woods is around policy 320S. Did I hear you say that you have some comments around that, around something that's being reworked? I know that it is something that is being redrafted. Do we have an expectation of when Access will be putting that out for public comment? Or did I hear you correctly that maybe it's already out for public comment?
So it's not posted yet, the draft policy for public comment. It is expected to be posted, I believe, within the next month, depending upon other competing priorities that may come up for Access leadership between now and then. Access has updated our public policy procedure, though, to where comment can be received at any time on any comment, or excuse me, on any policy through our public comment website. So any individual can submit comment, which we have received several comments from community members and stakeholders over the last few months related to the policy. Once there have been kind of word gotten out that the policy was being looked at for updates.
I would just encourage that Access partner with this committee as well as our executive staff to make sure that when there is a draft that can be commented on, not the existing draft, but a new draft, that it would please just make sure that you share that information with our executive director so that she can share with us, so that we make sure we get that on as something we review and perhaps provide comments back as the committee.
Absolutely. We would welcome that.
Thank you. So I think to summarize, I want to be clear that we're not creating any new loopholes. We are simply trying to clarify that if you are under supervision, these are the rules of supervision per Arizona Administrative Code. And we understand that we need to get people working at the highest level they possibly can. We have found the exemption that we believe allows us to extend that authority, given that the person is still under supervision and that the LBA, that is the supervisor, is taking full responsibility for that individual and for all of the cases underneath that individual. And I believe that is the spirit of which we tried to capture in the substantive policy.
I just want to extend a thank you to Dr. Davey, Dr. Dana Davis-Wilson, and to Ms. Pecadon for working on this. I know it was, I'm sure, not an easy process, and I'm sure also volunteer. So thank you guys for committing all of your time towards this. I know as a committee member, I will find it helpful to be able to reference this as opposed to like, so what does supervision kind of look like? And they're like, oh, we do some stuff. Oh, okay. And then we have to, you know, move on because we don't have anything really concrete to rely on. So I am grateful as a committee member to have this become available to us. So I just want to say thank you. Dr. Davis-Wilson.
I apologize, and it might tie into your guys' last agenda item. But, you know, I think I listened in on the meeting last time, and I think that one of the important points that was made was, again, around the use of the titles. And so I do think that this policy does a really good job saying, look, you're either licensed or you're a trainee. There is no you're a BCBA. There is no you're a clinical director, but you're pending licensure. So someone else is meeting with you once a week. This really does clarify it, where you wouldn't have a subordinate able to just meet with you twice a week and do all of those things. I think what that then could open, and this would be a discussion for you guys, but what that could open is in the application process, when you are seeing those, hey, I'm a BCBA, I'm practicing as a BCBA, you know, I haven't seen the portal, but if it asks like, are you practicing as a BCBA or you're in these capacities or whatever, and they say yes, then to have you, that policy would allow for what an attestation from a supervisor could look like. So that supervisor could say, yes, I have reviewed all of this. I take responsibility for all the clients that they have been working with. I do these things, you know, or I don't know, you guys could create a form that would prompt some of that attestation based off of what's already been identified in this policy. And perhaps that would help with some of those things that when they answer yes in that, now they need to upload this attestation from their supervisor that states, yes, I'm in compliance with these points. And then I think, because I, even down to the idea of it needs to be documented in a plan, I don't think that needs to be something you guys need to see every single time somebody is before the board. I think if we can, if the supervisors are attesting to, yes, I met these criteria, including
taking responsibility for the client, I think that that could suffice. And when it does not, that would allow for you guys to request that additional documentation. So that's when you could look at how are you relaying this to families? How are you doing those things? If it were to be a concern. But I think that's what, in the way that we have it outlined, in the way that we tried to simplify it, I know it's a lot of legalese language, to just basically say, again, you're either a technician, a trainee, or are you a licensed behavior analyst? And there shouldn't be anything else in between. And here's how we're defining that. And I'm hopeful that'll help with your guys' application concerns that were presented as well.
With that, is there any more comments or discussion? Okay, I know we talked a bit about the verbiage in there. Does anyone want to make a motion to have Dr. Davey and Dr. Davis-Wilson, who have been voluntold to maybe make some recommendation changes? Do we have a motion surrounding that?
So moved.
Do we have a second?
Second.
All right. It is motion is made by Ms. Denton. It's been seconded by Dr. Stenhoff. All those in favor?
Can we just have just a bit of discussion? Once we go back and take the feedback to kind of clean up the individual the feedback with regard to individual contracts for each client and get that back into more of a supervision contract that would be more umbrella around those they might serve, and maybe some language around treatment plans, something like that, or applicable documentation of approach to treatment. I think we can probably find a code for that. Can we have also permission to move this forward to the next stage, which would be, I believe, in front of Ms. Galvin? Is that correct, Ms. Packinen?
Well, Madam Chair, yes, Dr. Davey. I do think that before this goes to the board, it deserves to have, a very close analysis by Ms. Galvin, and I will leave it up to her discretion, who she wants to implicate, if anyone, as she does that. So, I think that's an important interim step.
Okay. So I just, as a friendly amendment to the motion, that we be allowed to get it to Jean as the next step.
Do you have to second an amendment?
The original person has to agree to my amendment, and then... Oh.
Amendment agreed to.
And seconded.
All right. So Ms. Denton has agreed. Dr. Stenhoff seconded again, I guess. So moved. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? All right. Motion carries. I realize we are almost done, but if we could just do like a real quick, 4-minute comfort break and come back at 1:05. I just think we might have some discussion around 11 and I'm agenda 11. So if we could, do I need to make a motion for a comfort break? No. Okay. Comfort break. Yay. See you back in 4 minutes. Back here. Yes. Okay. Very good. So we'll move on to agenda item number 11, discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding proposed modifications to employment section of the application. So again, Ms. Packinon, will you take it away?
Certainly. Well, my voice is still hopefully holding out a little while longer. This is a very closely related agenda item to the one that you just heard, of course, in that, committee members as the application sort of morphs and modifies, as the content that is presented to committee members through that new summary review, as that, is modified and morphs, we're finding that maybe you aren't getting all the information that you would ideally need when an applicant represents that they are present in Arizona, or the indications are they could be present in Arizona and they could be working in Arizona, and in what capacity. You may not, the application file may not tell the story, as we observed earlier in the meeting. there were several instances where the applicant was able to, you know, provide that explanation to the committee's satisfaction. But ideally, that information is gathered for the committee members and available in the file when you receive it. So what this document attempts to do is to capture what Dr. Byra, you know, stepped out in front of this and said, I really want to, you know, to lead on this and work on this. So we had, I think, a very productive session where we were bringing forward some recommendations where not only do we modify what the applicant is asked and required to supply, but then also, of course, what the committee sees. I don't know if in light of the fact that the draft SPS still needs some work, you know, maybe that doesn't, maybe that means that this project isn't quite ready, but I think that's really the committee's task today to determine if we are at the point where the suggested revisions can be, we have to explore how to implement them. By that, I mean, you know, we have to get with the system developer. By way of reminder, you know, we have only so much latitude within the architecture of the system itself. It is a customizable but off-the-shelf product that we use. That being said, if we lay out requirements to them, they will tell us what they're capable of doing, and they're pretty creative in the process. And I don't recall a whole lot of instances where they've said, we can't do what you need. And so we've sort of had to figure out a workaround. So I'm happy to go into, you know, the summary, which is on page 2 of your memorandum, really the two sets of proposed revisions that Dr. Byra and I landed on. If you'd like, I'll move right to that. Okay, so the top section, top box, represents a portion of the screen that applicants see that are specific to the employment section. So what we are suggesting is that there is a question in here that has been, wait a minute, why do I have the wrong screenshot in here? Well, you'll have to forgive me. I don't know why I put the wrong screenshot in here. At any rate, we do have a question in the employment section that prompts for nature of work, and it's a text field. We think that that's vague and ambiguous, so we would love to see that question modified from, you know, nature of work to do you currently work in a behavior analytic capacity in Arizona? That's much more, you know, direct. We present a yes option and a no option. And if yes is selected, then the applicant is required to name a supervisor, provide their license number, upload a file that addresses frequency and length of supervision, type of documentation collected that represents that supervision, and upload a copy of the supervision plan. So I believe this all to be, you know, very easy changes to that section of the application. May or may not cost us, but if there is a cost, I can't see it being terribly expensive. So for what it is worth, what I think these changes would do would essentially capture the questions that you were posing to applicants earlier today anyway.
Yep. Dr. Davey?
Love it. I think it's great. I have one question. And looking at this, it's kind of, my question is, you're probably going to think it's a strange question, which is fine, because I'm a strange person when it comes to this. The question really is, like, when we ask the name of the supervisor, they're going to give us, you know, Supervisor X, supervisor's Arizona license number. Let's just say that this is one of those cases where the person is in Arizona, but is not doing it right. So now the process stops because they don't have an Arizona license number. Are we going to allow an NA to go there so that we can still, you know, identify individuals that are supervising in the state of Arizona without the proper credential? Because my fear is, an applicant will do this, get to this point, and then call their supervisor, and their supervisor's like, oh crap, I'm only licensed in Illinois. And then they shut this whole thing down, and we don't know what happens to that person, to the next person, or anybody else from the past. So I would just encourage us not to make this too smart. I don't know how to say that properly, right? I don't want it to be completely idiot proof. I think there's got to be a chance for someone to tell us that something's not quite right and for us to be able to identify it. I don't know if I articulated that correctly, but I would like to see something in the functionality that would allow someone to move forward by answering these questions and not stop them if they're not complying with Arizona administrative code.
Can I speak to that, Madam
Chair? Go ahead.
Sorry. You go first.
No, let's go ahead.
Oh, I don't see any reason why we couldn't, Dr. Davey, if we just specify that this is an, you know, open field where, you know, somebody could put any content in there whatsoever. You know, that's it won't be too smart. It won't be too restrictive. And it won't. Dr. Byron, I sort of had this a little bit of conversation around this, you know, what do we do if someone just sort of gets a little creative with their answer? Well, you know, we can only do our best here, but I think you're raising a good point. And I think that we can make sure that what you're describing doesn't enable that kind of entry.
Right. Because, and Ms. Denton, I see your hand up there, but I mean, you could argue that even with the, do you work in, you know, a behavioral analytic capacity in Arizona, and they click yes, and all this other crap comes up. Oh, I don't have a supervision contract to upload. I'm going to click no now. Right. I mean, I would hope that people wouldn't be dishonest in their application, but I'd rather err on the side of caution of asking the questions than people, you know, being dishonest and just not asking. And then we don't get the data. I take your point. I wouldn't flag it. And it says, oh, it doesn't meet a case, like the case sensitivity. This isn't a real license number. So you're flagged and we're going to come get you. But I think people can figure out what's happening here pretty fast otherwise.
And I think also this is a great opportunity for us to put out an announcement via our own listserv, as well as AZABA, as well as anybody else. You know, we can put it out on social media of like, hey, the application's been updated with these particular questions, right? I mean, how awesome would it be for us to put that out there that, hey, you're now, if you're working underneath somebody, you're going to have to upload a copy of that supervision plan. That in and of itself will trigger some people to be thinking about what they're doing.
Right.
So I think that when we get ready to roll this out, you know, with like 30-day notice that the application process is changing, I think we should highlight this and be very overt about our intent.
Agreed.
Good work.
Ms. Denton.
I'd like to show a little bit of like love for you. Like, this is fantastic. Like, you're wonderful. Like, it's all amazing. And I think this will help remediate some of the challenges that we see whenever we're reviewing applications for, I don't know, the last like year. I think it's come up on every single meeting that we've been on. So your ability to identify a problem and to find a solution is fantastic. Could we just switch it to, instead of Arizona supervisor's Arizona license number, to does this supervisor have an Arizona license, yes or no? Because we're going to be pulling their license anyway as part of that supervisor verification process. And then it would be pretty clear if, nope, they don't have a license. One idea. The other question that I had would be, what happens if you have more than one supervisor because you're at a multi-supervisor experience and you've got this supervisor is overseeing these three cases and this supervisor is overseeing those four cases? Do you have the option to put in multiple supervisors?
From a software component, yes. I mean, you could, if it's an open text field, you could do, you know, Tisha Denton, comma, Dr. Stenhoff, comma, right? If it's an open text field, you could add multiple. And then in terms of the, you know, the upload feature, usually there's not like a limit. Like if you want to put everything in like one 300 page PDF, you could upload it that way, or you could do multiple individuals. So from a software perspective, again, Sentia is not where I build. I build on a different platform, but they're pretty, the way it functions seems to be pretty similar. So I think from a software perspective, that should be no problem. We just wouldn't limit. We do like a bigger text box as opposed to, you know, a little shorty. Like we'd only fit one name. We could do a small text field and have it be like a paragraph format. So if you want to do multiple supervisors, you should be able to list all of them.
And I think, you know, it just came to mind because as we are talking about earlier, you know, the trainee situation and one person realizing like, oh no, I can't have 45 clients underneath my LBA, underneath these 10 supervisees, right? Then it very well could trigger some action, hopefully, where like, okay, we've got to split this up, right? We've got to have, if we are going to have this many trainees, you know, who is overseeing these cases versus these cases. And, you know, since we don't make modifications to our software very often, just trying to think about how we could prevent it or proactively, you know, plan for that if that is what happens.
Yeah, absolutely. But I'm hoping it speeds up the application review process, just from our perspective, not trying to guess of, is this company multi-state, multi-location? Is it plausible that they're working here? So we're not guessing and then having to hope that someone shows up to the call. And if they happen not to be able to, we're issuing fares. And that's just a huge tax on all the board staff to have to do all of that paperwork and things like that. And it delays someone's application, you know, being accepted when they maybe do have all their ducks in a row. So, and then if not, then hopefully this is going to be prompting folks to learn from example to get their ducks in a row so that they're practicing and in compliance. So, I like to be efficient.
We do too.
Other questions?
I heard the revisions, descriptions to the text fields that you want to have, and you know, affirming that we want very open-ended text fields, and you know, not sort of, we wouldn't want the license number field, even if we were to retain it, to be, you know, in the format that it's required to be entered. So I will make those changes to what the requirements, these will be submitted to the development team, right? So I'll make those corrections, but we need to talk about too then the other, the flip side, which is of course what you get to see as a committee. I did post the right screenshot, fortunately, on the bottom half of your memo, that presents what that section of the summary view looks like, the employment section. And if this is an easy fix, I know this to be the case. If we can just have the developers pull the state field into this section, into this table, we don't care about street address. We don't care about city. As long as it represents Arizona or Kentucky or Maine, that's really all we care about, right? And then also pull in the work in a behavior analytic capacity in Arizona data into that table as well. And then delete primary column from the table. Primary is the, I guess it's almost all the way to the right, the second from the right column. That doesn't bring any value to the summary view. So we would ditch that in favor of pulling in that other data that you can see at a glance. In the employment section, you're going to be looking at everything else, of course, but just having that overview of their employment, I think is important. What you're really going to be looking for is, there's Arizona. I need to pay attention. I see an entry that's Arizona. If you don't see an Arizona entry, then, you know, that will compel you to look at this through a different lens.
And will that help Z as well, trying to track down stuff? Just out of curiosity.
I think that there is a risk. I'm going to be honest. There's a risk that anytime you ask, you put any question on an application, you know the saying, garbage in, garbage out. So it may be that even though we think our question is worded so clearly that there's no ambiguity about what we're asking and what it means, it doesn't mean that, you know, we won't get something that makes no sense or raises more questions than it really does. So I think if we stay the course and you see these applications come to you, even if what the applicant has entered, it is raises red flags, doesn't make sense, is, you know, unclear in any way, it still needs to come to the committee to sort out. So let's stay the course in terms of not forcing Zakiya to try to translate what it is that somebody entered. These are applicants who are responsible for the contents of their application. The onus is on them to show that they qualify for licensure. If they can't answer a question effectively, then they need to hear that feedback from the committee when their application is substantively reviewed. So this will create, you know, a little bit more work in terms of anytime there's an upload involved, right? And we are requesting or requiring, I should say, an upload. So yes, that is going to be, you know, one more document that she needs to manage when she assembles a file. But I think as long as we don't revert back to this practice of Z makes sense of this before it gets to the committee, then we're not going to lose that processing time. I hope that's clear.
It is. Thank you.
Other points of discussion, questions, comments?
So do we see any hindrance or any reason to withhold moving this forward in light of the SPS? I don't, but I want to make sure the committee sees it the same way.
I don't see any reason.
Okay.
No concern here.
Okay. Well, I will get that submitted. The development team is in, they happen to be in Croatia. So I'm going to wait until Monday. No, I'm going to send it to them now. They'll wake up to it on Monday morning. So maybe we'll get a quick turnaround. So
Do we need a motion for that?
May as well.
Okay.
I'm moved.
Second, anybody?
Second.
All right. Dr. Davey made the motion. Ms. Denton seconded. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right. Motion carries. All right. Item number 12, new agenda items for future meetings. Does anyone have any items they would like to put on a future agenda meeting? All right. I'll take your silence as a no. All right. Then item number 13. Adjourn. It is now 1:25 p.m. and I exercise my prerogative as chair to adjourn this meeting.
Do we need one more code word before we adjourn?
Oh, maybe.
If you want one more code word, I can give you one more.
Yes,
you do want it. There's always a theme. We want it.
It's auction. Auction. Thank you.
Right. Thank you, Ms. Malice. And thanks, Ms. Pakanon, for the reminder. Anything else? All right. Thanks for everyone for showing up. Have a lovely weekend.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you.